You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Johan Galtung. He is the founder of the discipline of peace studies. He founded the International Peace Research Institute in Oslo in 1959 and the Journal of Peace Research in 1964. He has helped found dozens of peace centers. He has taught peace studies at universities all over the world and mediated hundreds of conflicts. He is the author or co-author of over 160 books and is cited and discussed in, it is safe to say, many thousands more. He is the founder of Transcend Peace University and Transcend International. You can go to transcend.org to learn more. Johan Galtung, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
My pleasure, David, indeed. Thank you so much for inviting me.
I'm very glad to, and there are more topics I want to ask you about than we will possibly fit in, so I think we'll have to start with the most serious one, or the most current one. What do we do about ISIS, Iraq, and Syria?
If you look at it from an ISIS point of view, the question is, what do we do about the West? That is always intervening and interfering in Muslim and Arab affairs and colonizing us and so on. So as usual, an issue has two sides, or maybe more than two sides, and they are trying to do something about us, and there are people in the West trying to do something about them. So you ask the question, what is going to happen, or something like that. Well, first of all, take note of one point. Syria and Iraq were established by betrayal of the Arab people. They were asked in 1915 by Lord Sykes, the British foreign minister, and Picot, the French foreign minister, to rebel against the Ottoman Empire. And if they so did and managed to get rid of it, they would be rewarded with freedom. Instead, France secured for itself two colonies, Syria and Lebanon, and England secured for itself two colonies, Palestine and Iraq. And most of the problems with what we today associate with Middle East has to do with the betrayal. And it is known as such. Any Arab child knows about this. Very few people in the West even know about it. That's the point of departure. You would expect that there would be an effort not only to liberate Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, and Palestine from Paris and London. That happened. But the whole structure was wrong. It had nothing to do with what was there before, which was the big carpet of what is called Vilayat, the provinces, with lots of local autonomy, so-called millets. And that was the Ottoman Empire. And when you say ISIS, be aware of the fact that it is not only Islamic State, Iraq, Syria, but it's also the dream of re-establishing a caliphate, the kind of carpet I mentioned with provinces. They may kill ISIS soldiers, and the experience is that if you kill one, you get 10 the next day, because this is very deeply ingrained in them, the liberation from the Sykes-Picot structure, if you will, and reinventing the caliphate without Istanbul, not from Istanbul, but so far, basically for Sunni Islam.
Well, the question that is always put to me and has been put to me by you is beyond not killing, because killing makes it worse. You generate 10 new enemies for everyone you kill, even according to the U.S. generals. What do you do instead? What should you do instead? You've given me some words of wisdom in the past. You know, our politicians in Washington and London and Paris don't much mind our protesting. What they mind is our having a different plan. But, well, what is that plan and how do we make it happen? What should we be doing instead of dropping bombs on ISIS?
I think one has, first of all, to simply understand what's happening. So what is called ISIS, point one, is retribution, vengeance. for the American atrocities in Iraq, the terrible violence in connection with the invasion and afterwards. The invasion, March 19, 2003, more than 12 years ago, and from a Muslim point of view, retribution is an obligation, but it should be moderate. So they define the decapitation as a moderate retribution for the, by some counts, 1 million that have been killed in Iraq since the early 1990s. So that's point one, bad enough. Point two is, if you will, simply to get rid of Iraq and Iraq and Syria as entities. And that has to do with undoing Sykes-Picot. So that is why the acronym ISIS was chosen to start with. Now, what would they like to set in place? Well, they would like to have a carpet of wilayat. That carpet in Islam has a name. It's called an ummah, the community of the believers, and it is dotted with mosques and sharia, meaning courts, sharia courts. And the head of each local community is an imam, and there are many of them. But when you then ask, what can we do? Well, use the Western military defensively. Protect the minorities or the groups that ISIS, let's call it that for the time being, are attacking. Protect them. That is done by parachuting down troops with not necessarily long-distance weapons, but simply protecting. A ring, a circle around them. It's amazing to see that with all that military competence of Pentagon, the only thing they seem to be able to invent is offensive use of the military, killing people and destroying infrastructure and so on. So that's the first thing that should have been done from the very beginning. And you can even hold the Western military responsible for not having done it. Then we come to the third aspect of ISIS. And the third aspect of ISIS is, of course, the caliphate. That's a dream. The caliphate collapsed in 1924 as an outcome of Sykes-Picot. It collapsed. If you could imagine that the Vatican collapses, there would be strong Catholic forces to restore it. And if you could imagine that some force in the world is systematically bombing Catholic countries, then you have an image of what happens in the Middle East. The caliphate collapsed, and then bombing of one Muslim country after the other. For the West to believe that they can do that and the people in that region will simply accept it hands down is an unbelievable naivete. It shows how extremely badly informed they are. Something like ISIS was the most predictable thing you can imagine. And then comes, you see, the point that the caliphate. Have a look at, Google it, and have a look at the old caliphate. The caliphate known as also the Ottoman Empire. That was the, if you will, secular side of it, military, economic side of it, political. The cultural side was the caliphate. Well, it's quite big. But take note of one point. What the struggle is really about is who is going to rule and to run the most sacred parts of Islam, namely the mosques in Mecca and Medina. The Saudi royalty seemed to prefer to be away and swim in the Riviera with about 1,000 invited friends, and are not even able to control stampedes when the Muslims are running in connection with the Hajj, the pilgrimage. Not even that. So there was a public opinion poll in Saudi Arabia recently, and people were asked, who is today the true carrier of Islam? 92% said the Islamic State. Okay. I think the real struggle is not in some villages and some districts in Iraq and Syria, where the Islamic State has, to their, in their words, liberated a territory the size of about Great Britain. The real struggle is about Saudi Arabia, with 92% seemingly being in favor of the Islamic State. You can make some predictions about how that would end up. And then comes to my mind, in my view, with my experience in this and the Skyping and the conversations I have with them, a fourth aspect. They are fully aware of Sunni Shia, and they want to get rid of it. They simply want to build a bridge. Don't be surprised if there is some kind of accord between Iran and Sunni Islam. Don't be surprised. They know perfectly well that the West makes use of this twist, this divide, from the years after the death of the Prophet. And let us not get into that. I don't think there will be a theological union, but it could be a military, economic, political union. The way Catholics and Protestants in Europe came together in the European Community Union and NATO, a defense alliance against Orthodox Europe headed by Russia. And of course, Russia then dominating Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. Okay, you have an image, and if you want to try to destroy the Islamic State, you are up against quite a lot. And I don't think there's any way in which the West is able to do it. They can do some bombing in Syria and Iraq. That is only touching the tip of the iceberg. Defensive use of the military, and then you simply enter into dialogue with them. And I think the basic dialogue issue, since they want to reconstruct the caliphate of 1924 when there was no Israel, the basic dialogue issue would be whether there is nevertheless space for some kind of Israel in all of this. And it seems to me that the West could gamble on two strong cards on the Muslim side. One of them is the tradition. I mentioned the word millet, autonomous of different religion and language inside the Ottoman Empire, and define Israel as something similar to that. And the other one is that Islam, being the latest of the three Abrahamic religions, is much more knowledgeable of and much more tolerant of Judaism and Christianity than vice versa. And I'm not quite sure that the West possesses that skill today.
We're speaking with Johann Galtung. You can find him at transcend.org. Johann, it's very interesting to me that you propose using the U.S. military defensively, your word, in countries thousands of miles away to defend threatened populations, because this is, of course, what the United States government and the United Nations tell us that the U.S. military is doing in many, many cases. We were told that the U.S. and allies needed to go into Libya to defend helpless people, and they quickly turned that into a overthrow of the government. We were told that they needed to go in and defend helpless people on a mountaintop against ISIS, and that quickly became an ongoing, endless effort to overthrow ISIS while trying to overthrow the government of Syria. Is it really feasible that we could get the U.S. military to go into a foreign country thousands of miles away and actually behave as you want them to, and how would we go about making that happen?
Technically, it's, of course, totally feasible. You need planes, parachutes, parachuting down 1,000 troops or whatever, for each threatened part, constituting a circle with adequate arms. That's what you need. Technically, that's totally feasible. But take note, the question is whether that's in the mind of the U.S. military. They know how to do it. But I think the U.S. military is imitating Christianity in a fundamentalist sense. That Jesus Christ came up from the dead and took his position next to the Father. to punish and judge living and dead. Now, Washington seems to see itself as chosen by God, and for that reason, having the duty of judging and punishing. And defensive defense doesn't sound like judging and punishing. It sounds like defending victims, not judging perpetrators and punishing them. So I think they are simply on a totally wrong track, and it unfortunately has to do with the deep culture of the U.S. military. Quite sure it would be easy to reach them via dialogue and debate and protests and so on. What I would wish to see, David, if it is possible at all, would be a U.S. peace movement circling the Pentagon, circling the White House with big banners. Use the military defensively. Protect the exposed minorities. Things of that kind. Of course, comes from my general experience all these years, 60 years with mediation in very hot waters, to put it mildly. The Western powers, with their tradition of colonialism, intervention, United States alone having intervened militarily something like 248 times since Thomas Jefferson started in 1805, incidentally also in Libya. That's quite a lot. That tradition is so strong, and you can critique it, that doesn't make the slightest impact on them. They kick back. But if you have a plan B, then it's better than their violent plan A. That has an impact on them, to co-opt you. And one effort to co-opt the peace forces in the U.S. also cost the United States Institute of Peace. I think it's a bad joke, but let's leave that aside. The basic point about it is, it has to be brought to the attention, not only of the people high up in Washington, but of the general population. But this is a way of thinking and a way out.
Of course, you and I, Johann, see the endless wars and the idea of launching a counterproductive assault on ISIS as something without end. But I'm afraid if you went to the U.S. military and the U.S. government and the U.S. corporate media and said, let's use the military purely defensively, they would say, well, that will be endless. You will be defending these helpless people from ISIS endlessly for eternity unless you do something about ISIS. What would be done? What could be done simultaneously?
Negotiate with them. Simply try to find out, what does this caliphate look like? Will there be space for this and that? Negotiate peacefully. But you first have to recognize from the very beginning that if we in the West, the Catholic part of it, have the right to have a Vatican that stretches all over the world, they also have a right to have a caliphate. There's no way in which one can deny them that. No way in the name of freedom of culture, freedom of speech, all of that, freedom of religion, they are entitled to it. And I have indicated that one basic issue is the space for an Israel. Not an expanding, conquering Israel from the river in Africa to Euphrates, as it says in the Gospel in Genesis 1, in the beginning of Genesis. But in a sense, is there a space for something more modest? What would it look like? My experience talking with people in Islamic countries is that I talked, for instance, with people in Hamas, in the Gaza Strip. I talked with Hezbollah people in Lebanon. My experience is that the answer is yes. They can accept an Israel. 1967 borders is the slogan, which Netanyahu, of course, rejects completely. You may have to accept that one. That's considerably better than nothing. You say that there are sacred Judaic places on the West Bank and have some Israeli cantons on the West Bank. And there are very dear places for the Palestinians in northwest Israel and have some Palestinian cantons there. And you would weave the two states solidly together. But the way to peace and security passes through recognition of Israel. No Palestine.
I'm afraid a great many people will say, as is always said about every looming opponent in a war, these are the type of people you cannot negotiate with. It's said about Russia. It's said about Iran. But it's said much more successfully about ISIS. It is very easy to tell people in the United States, for example, that ISIS are not quite human. They are madmen, and you cannot sit down and talk and negotiate with them.
You said a great amount of people. Let us be honest. You mean a great amount of Americans. Americans are also people, but they're people of a very special kind, and they have a tendency to etiquette others and to be anti-others. Anti-terrorist, anti-communist, and by saying that, they have ruled out those people from the very beginning. Look, during the whole Cold War of 40 years, I spent considerable part of my life having dialogues with communists, and quite successfully so, playing some role in what ultimately happened. I'm now having dialogues with so-called terrorists, be they Taliban, Al-Qaeda, or whatever. And I have even had some dialogues in Pentagon and State Department. You see, you can sit down and talk, and I can give you an opening question, which is so enticing that most people will immediately jump on it. I would ask, for instance, what does the Middle East look like where you would like to live? What does Afghanistan look like where you would like to live? And listen to the flow of words, and you hear a lot of very reasonable things, and some of them problematic. But don't for a second think that you cannot sit down and talk with them.
If the United States does not heed your advice and continues down its war-making path and launches an all-out war on ISIS, will NATO join in? Will Europe join in? Will there be support for something that can be labeled international?
I would say not. They will not join in because they live a little bit closer to it and are more realistic. And are not so fundamentalist Christian as the top of the United States leadership is. No, you see it already in Ukraine. They're not joining. United States wants considerably harsher measures, and they're not joining, particularly France and Germany.
What about France and ISIS?
That is, I was just going to say it, a special issue because there is Syria involved. It was an old French colony. I agree with that, but you were mentioning NATO.
Yeah.
And the only country that has been really following United States is Russia. And that is not exactly because of ISIS. I think we all agree that that's more or less a pretext. It is more because the only Russian base outside the old Soviet Union is in Syria, as opposed to at least 800 U.S. bases outside U.S. territory.
Yeah, I'm afraid.
That's a major factor. And a couple of other factors, too, but let's leave them aside. Syria is complicated, and I think it will end up as a loose federation where the old province structure, the vilayat, will be basic units. You see, Assad stands for the Alawite minority dictatorship. And the other side, the Sunni side, stands, well, as most say, for a majority dictatorship. Assad has shown more tolerance of minorities in his dictatorship with the millet system than is indicated from the Sunni side. Well, I think the choice is a bad one. And the possibility of a loose federation with many parts would, in a sense, meet quite a lot of demand. It would also be an inherent preparation for what, to my mind, is inevitable, namely some reconstruction of the old caliphate based on this vilayat, these provinces.
Johan, what you say about Europe is very encouraging, but what about Norway? Because you were, we were talking yesterday and you were critiquing my article I wrote about the Vikings and the Vikings having become less violent. And you were suggesting that maybe Norway today is not actually less violent than the Vikings. Can you explain?
I'm very ashamed of my country, because it was willing to do what very few countries are willing to do, to kill for the United States, and they did it in Libya. The Norwegian Prime Minister was called by the French President, Sarkozy, and asked whether the Norwegian Air Force could be helpful. And after that, he was called by Obama. Now, ours is a small country, and it is very obvious that the Prime Minister, who is now Secretary General of NATO, that was the reward he got for all of this, was very flattered. They had 660 sorties and the bombing over a period of 7 months. In the beginning, coordinates. Later on, they were bombing a territory the size of southern Norway, according to a more or less defecting general on the Norwegian side, and literally speaking, bombing everything that moved. In other words, the old Vietnam strategy from the U.S. I'm ashamed of it. The Norwegian leadership knows perfectly well that it was not a success, and said, and that is one of the most horrible statements I have heard from my government, that it was an excellent opportunity for exercise for the Norwegian Air Force. Now, you don't kill people for exercise. Exercise you do in some exercise place. And the guy who said it was the very same Prime Minister who became Secretary General of NATO. So I think Norway is now almost the only country, and I am not so sure they will do it again, willing to kill for the U.S. That doesn't mean that the U.S. doesn't kill. But poor United States, they now have to do the killing themselves. And by some counts, they are doing that in 134 countries by sharpshooters. The drones are not that important. The local CIA points out who is to be eliminated. And the sharpshooter takes an ordinary plane with a long thing checked in, an extremely good rifle with telesight and everything, and they are very professional, can do it at 1.2 kilometers, for instance, taking into account, let us say, some little whiff of wind after 800 meters. I mean, no doubt about their professionalism, but it is warfare, and by some count, in 134 countries. In the old days, and they were not that far away, the U.S. could call upon local elites to do the killing for them. That is much less the case, and will be even less and less the case.
There is good news and bad news in that, and we are going to have you back on the program to go further. Johan Galtung, you can find out more about Johan at transcend.org. Thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
And thank you so much for having me. And goodbye, United States, as imperial power. You're making yourself irrelevant with your stupid foreign policy.
Thank you. This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Countersmith.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, while many folks go to family or friends for Thanksgiving dinner, somewhere around 15 million Americans have that holiday meal at a restaurant, with more millions ordering food to eat at home. Of course, what that means is that millions of restaurant workers don't have a choice about where to have their Thanksgiving. And of course, that's only a small part of the things that make work in that industry difficult and, for many, precarious. But change is afoot with a movement to outlaw the tipped wage, the idea that a minimum wage of $2.13 is okay because waitstaff get enough involuntary tips to make up for it. The change is driven by persistent efforts of restaurant workers and their representatives, and eminent among those is our guest, Saru Jayaraman. She's co-founder and co-director of the Restaurant Opportunities Centers and director of the Food Labor Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley. She's also author of the books Behind the Kitchen Door and the upcoming Forked, A New Standard for American Dining. We'll have that interview with Saru Jayaraman coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at the week's press. CNN host Michael Smirkanish brought onto his November 21st show former CIA officer Michael Scheuer, who said that if the U.S. is going to go after ISIS, it should
take out every piece of infrastructure, hospitals, universities, irrigation systems that make it impossible for the Islamic State to raise money to provide electricity, sanitation, potable water. Do exactly what we did to the Germans.
Asked by the CNN host whether the U.S. public would tolerate the so-called innocent civilian death count, Scheuer replied, quote, "They should. What's the difference? They're not Americans," close quote. Well, Scheuer's proudly sociopathic views should come as no surprise. In December of 2013, he called for the assassination of President Barack Obama and British Prime Minister David Cameron, approvingly citing 17th century political theorist Algernon Sidney's assertion that by an established law among the most virtuous nations, every man might kill a tyrant, and no names are recorded in history with more honor than of those who did it. Of course, Scheuer's enthusiasm for murdering world leaders didn't keep him from being a guest on Lou Dobbs' Fox News show the very next month. As far back as 2009, Scheuer was hoping for a weapon of mass destruction to be used against the U.S. As he told Fox's Glenn Beck,
"The only chance we have as a country right now is for Osama bin Laden to deploy and detonate a major weapon in the United States. Only Osama can execute an attack which will force Americans to demand that their government protect them effectively, consistently, and with as much violence as necessary."
As a news producer, you can take two approaches. You can view news as a form of entertainment, whose only goal is to maximize ratings, in which case bringing on an obvious kook to rant like a James Bond villain makes perfect sense. Or you can consider that you live in a real world with real people, many of whom might actually come to harm when you give fanatics a prominent platform to advocate for war crimes. It seems clear which approach CNN has decided to go for. So you might think, looking at Michael Smirkanish bringing on a guest to call for massacring civilians and then referring to the so-called innocent civilian death count, that you can pretty much say whatever you want at CNN. But you'd be wrong. There are some opinions that can get you in serious trouble as a CNN journalist. Take correspondent Elise Labbitt, who tweeted on November 19th about a congressional vote on refugee policy. She wrote, quote, "House passes bill that could limit Syrian refugees. Statue of Liberty bows head in anguish," close quote. Washington Post blogger Eric Wemple detected partisan bias in this tweet and demanded that CNN explain how it conformed to its editorial guidelines. Later in the day, Labatt issued an abject retraction on Twitter. That wasn't enough for CNN, which suspended the reporter for 2 weeks as punishment. Journalist and media critic Glenn Greenwald pointed out at The Intercept that Labatt's crime was not expressing an opinion, but expressing the wrong sort of opinion. He noted that, quote, Labatt's punishment comes just 5 days after two CNN anchors spent 6 straight minutes lecturing French Muslim civil rights activist Yasser Louadi that he and all other French Muslims bear responsibility for the attack. The anchors weren't suspended for expressing those repulsive opinions, close quote. Another opinion that didn't merit any criticism, let alone punishment from CNN, the network's Jim Acosta demanding of Barack Obama, quote, I think a lot of Americans have this frustration that they see that the United States has the greatest military in the world. I guess the question is, and if you'll forgive the language, is why can't we take out these bastards? Close quote. Complaining that the president is not bombing hard enough is the kind of opinion you get paid to have at CNN. But questioning whether Congress is being too hard on refugees, that evidently is beyond the pale. And finally, when Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump says he personally saw thousands and thousands of people in an Arab American community in New Jersey cheering as the Twin Towers fell on September 11th, or that Barack Obama plans to allow entry to 250,000 immigrants who are mainly young, strong men with no documents, there's a word for that, and the word is lies. Media serve no one by pretending otherwise. So it's not clear what, hey, CNN, for example, thinks it's doing with a segment like that of November 25th, in which correspondent Sarah Murray referred to Trump's controversial comment, his widely disputed claim, his sometimes casual relationship with the facts, and even closed the segment with Trump's own language, which calls what he does truthful hyperbole. As Kevin Drum wrote for Mother Jones, it's way past time for this stuff. Descriptors like questionable, controversial, salesman-like, or disputed are just inappropriate. And outlets like CNN, which ran an earlier segment with the chyron, Does Donald Trump Transcend the Truth?, have to decide whether their job involves sorting truth from falsehood or not. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The truth of the matter is, this is a big deal, says Simon King, general manager of The Modern, a high-end restaurant attached to the Museum of Modern Art in Manhattan. He's referring to the decision by Danny Meyer, owner of The Modern and many other restaurants, to phase out what the New York Times called the time-honored American practice of tipping. That such a time-honored practice is now being challenged has a lot to do with our guest and her work. Saru Jayaraman is the co-founder and co-director of the Restaurant Opportunity Centers United and director of the Food Labor Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley. She's author of the book Behind the Kitchen Door and the upcoming Forked, A New Standard for American Dining. She joins us now by phone from California. Welcome to Counterspin, Saru Jayaraman.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, tipping and the tipped wage is not the only issue facing restaurant workers, but let's start there. What do you think people don't understand about the way that practice works and its impact on workers?
I think most people know almost nothing at all about this issue, including legislators in the highest levels of office. We've had to do a lot of education with people on the issue. And I'll say even me, myself, until about 10 years ago, really beginning to work in this industry and with workers across the country, knew very little myself. I think the big thing people should know is that it is the second largest and fastest growing sector of our economy, but pays the absolute lowest paying wages in the country. And that is due to the money, power, and influence of a trade lobby called the National Restaurant Association, which leads the Fortune 500 chains, restaurant chains in our country, and whose power dates back over 100 years to the emancipation of the slaves, when they essentially first fought for the right to not pay workers anything, especially former slaves who were the first tipped workers in our country, not pay them anything and let them live on customer tips. And there's just such a great deal of misinformation about who those workers are today, even. You know, there's such a misperception that the Restaurant Association likes to promote that these are very well-paid, tipped workers, white guys working in fancy fine dining restaurants, when in fact the vast majority of tipped workers in America, 70% in fact, are women who work at IHOP and Applebee's and Olive Garden and earn a median wage of $9 an hour, including tips, and suffer from 3 times the poverty rate of the rest of the U.S. workforce and the highest rates of sexual harassment of any industry in the United States because they are forced to live in large part on tips rather than receiving a wage from their employer.
Well, some of the defenses of tipping that are being brought out now really reflect that kind of feudal attitude. Richard Cohen at the Washington Post writes, quote, "I like to reward, but occasionally I like to punish," close quote. I mean, and it really gets at something, I think, at a kind of the baseline and telling you, hearing you say the origins of it really are, it really does come from that kind of attitude that people should serve at your pleasure.
That's right. And let me be clear, because, you know, what I really appreciate about your show and program is, you know, really clearing up what maybe other media sources have conflated. You know, our fight, our campaign is not actually at this minute to eliminate tipping altogether. That's a huge misconception. We are trying to eliminate the lower wage for tipped workers, which this industry has gotten away with for over 100 years. The true history is that tipping originated in Europe. When it came to the United States in the late 1850s, there was a massive anti-tipping movement so great that 5 states passed bans on tipping. And 2 industries, the restaurant industry and the Pullman Train Company, squashed that movement and demanded the right to hire newly freed slaves and not pay them anything and let them live on customer tips. And that idea that the restaurant industry in particular could not pay its workers a wage and let them live on customer tips was codified into the very first minimum wage law as part of the New Deal, which gave tipped workers the right to a $0 minimum wage. And we've gone from $0 in 1938 to a whopping $2.13 an hour, which is the federal minimum wage for tipped workers in our country. Now, there are 7 states that have completely eliminated that system and demand that the restaurant industry actually pay its workers a full wage and let tips be on top of that. California, Oregon, Washington, Nevada, Minnesota, Montana, and Alaska all demand that the restaurant industry pay a full wage and let tips be on top. And so our campaign, our effort has been to eliminate that lower wage for tipped workers, that two-tiered system that's essentially legalized gender pay inequity because it's mostly women living on the lower wage. Our fight is to eliminate that lower wage for tipped workers everywhere across the country, not at this minute to eliminate tipping. There are restaurants that have chosen to follow our lead and eliminate the lower wage for tipped workers in their restaurants by eliminating tipping. And if they're doing it in a transparent way that makes their workers whole, then we are fully in support of that. But right now we feel that, you know, as long as we're talking about minimum wages in this country of $10 and $12 and $15 an hour, that's actually not enough to live on anywhere in this country. And so tips are absolutely necessary at this moment on top of a wage to get workers closer to something livable. But what we don't want is what we have right now, which is that those tips can be counted against wages so that, in essence, most workers in this industry, in this country, are living almost entirely on customer power, on that sort of power to punish and or reward, rather than on a base wage from their employer like every other industry has to provide.
Well, let me ask you as a point of information, because when outlets like the New York Times and USA Today print articles about the tipped wage, as a matter of course, they get a letter from a representative of the National Restaurant Association
right.
that says no one gets a sub-minimum wage because if wait staff don't get enough from tips plus that $2.13 an hour to get up to minimum wage, the employer tops it off. Now, is that
yeah.
the law but not the case?
That's exactly not the case. And so the U.S. Department of Labor reports an 80% violation rate with regard to this issue of employers having to make up the difference hour by hour and ensure that tips actually bring you to the full minimum wage. I mean, it's, you know, I feel for employers. It's an extraordinary burden to have to ensure hour by hour. It takes, you know, a lot of accounting and HR, which most small businesses don't have. It's a tremendous burden on small business. And I will say, actually, this is partly why so many employers have started to move in our direction, why we're seeing so much industry shift on this issue, is because even some employer side attorneys have come out saying this is tremendous liability and burden on small businesses in particular that have to calculate this difference or get sued. So it doesn't happen. It's a huge liability. But really fundamentally on top of that, I want to say even if there was 100% compliance, which this issue, which there obviously isn't, it still wouldn't work. Because when you're a woman who lives off of tips for the majority of your income, as 6 million women in America do, you have to tolerate whatever a customer might do to you, however they may touch you or treat you or talk to you, because the customer is always right, because the customer is paying all of your income truly, because your wage is so low. If you get $2 or $3 or $4 an hour, as it is in 43 states, your wage is so low, it goes entirely to taxes and you're living completely off your tips. So if you're living completely off your tips, you're completely dependent on the whims of the customer, and you have to tolerate this kind of behavior. And our research shows it goes a step further. We found that management in states with lower wages for tipped workers encourages women to objectify themselves, wear tighter clothing, show greater cleavage in order to get more money in tips at 3 times the rate as they do in states like California, where a woman actually gets a full wage and doesn't have to rely on the whims of a customer. I mean, you know, that absurd comment by the Washington Post reporter, you know, in any other industry, any other service profession that we interact with daily, from retail to getting gas to anything that we do that where we interact with customer service, if we're not pleased with service, we have the right to go to management and complain. And that is how it should be in this industry, too. We have the right to go to management and complain. But a woman's ability to pay her bills and not have to sell her body and feed her family should not be dependent on the whims of customers. It should be dependent on her employer, who supposedly employs her and has the responsibility to ensure that she's actually paid for the work that she does.
Well, practices, as you've indicated, differ from state to state. There's some variation here, and some employ, I think you sort of referred to it, what they call a tip credit. What is going on there? What is a tip credit?
Yeah, it's a horrible misnomer, really. Some of our friends like to call it a tip penalty because it's really a penalty on the worker. Essentially, what some people call a tip credit is an employer's ability to discount a worker's wage so that then ultimately they only have to actually pay them as little as $2.13 an hour. They can say, because you're getting tips, I'm going to take this out of your wage so that I don't have to pay you a full wage. I can pay you as little as $2.13 and the remainder will be made up in tips. That's essentially what a tip credit or a tip penalty is. But, you know, I in my first book, Behind the Kitchen Door, I had a story of a young woman who worked at the IHOP in Houston, Texas. And IHOP is a multimillion-dollar corporation, should be able to figure this out. But when she started working at the IHOP in Houston, Texas, the manager told her, I don't want to have to be held liable to ensure that tips make up the difference for every hour, so that I'm going to report that you're making the full minimum wage of a whopping $7.25 an hour, whether or not you actually do. I don't care what you make in tips. That's what I'm going to report, which means that she's taxed on $7.25, even for those hours, and there are many of them in an IHOP, where nobody walks in the door. It's a graveyard shift, or it's very slow. It's open all night, right? There are many times when she's folding napkins or filling honey bottles or syrup bottles and not getting anything in tips, earning $2.13, which goes completely to taxes because she's being taxed as if she's earning $7.25 for every hour that she works.
Well, as we discussed with economist Holly Sklar last week in talking about the minimum wage generally, livable wages aren't just a matter of, you know, human decency or of economic security for individuals, but also for society as a whole, right?
That's absolutely right. I mean, not just for society as a whole, but for this very industry itself. I mean, What's really sad is over the last couple of years of economic crisis, our industry has grown, but the way it has grown has reflected growing income inequality in our country, in that the fine dining restaurants are booming. Fast food is booming. And that middle segment where a lot of America takes their family to eat, the Olive Gardens, like Chili's, that segment has not been growing. It's actually been stagnating compared to the other segments of the industry, which is a direct reflection on how this industry pays its own workers. Because this is the largest industry in America. The ability of these workers to actually afford to eat out is what sustains this industry itself. And so paying these workers a better wage would come right back into the industry itself. They would see that direct result if they would actually invest in workers' ability to survive and live and eat out like the rest of us.
Well, you've talked about what you call the Jim Crow in U.S. restaurants that has to do with gender and race sort of stratification. I mean, the truth is, if you've gone to a very expensive restaurant, some folks will notice, hey, all the people serving me are white men. You know, there is a gender and race element to this that's quite strong. You've talked a lot about the gender, but there are racial elements as well.
Oh, absolutely. People of color and women of color get segregated into lower level segments of the industry and lower tipping occupations and lower paid occupations. You will see people of color in casual restaurants and fast food restaurants. If they're in fine dining, you'll see them in what we call the back of the house, the kitchen, or in lower tipped positions like a busser or a runner who often earns 1/5 of the tips that a server will make. And so, you know, when the industry says nobody actually earns $2.13 an hour, these are well-paid tipped workers, well, there is a segment of the population for whom that's true. There are these wealthy white servers. I won't even say wealthy, actually. I will say better paid white servers who work in fine dining restaurants, and they should be paid a livable wage. They should be remunerated for the professional work that they do. This is a profession. It's a skilled profession, as it's recognized to be in other countries. But a big part of the problem is that people of color are not able to actually get to those great livable wage fine dining server and bartending positions. Those jobs are not accessible to the vast majority of workers in this industry. So we need to do two things. We need to lift the floor by eliminating the lower wage for tipped workers and raising the wage overall for everybody. And we need to build the ladder. We need to lift the floor and build the ladder so that while we're lifting the floor, we also create much better ability for workers to move into continuously higher paying positions, especially fine dining server and bartending positions, which can be family supporting jobs.
Right. Everyone knows somebody who makes a great living off tips, you know, but
right,
the point
right
is that people are not equally situated or don't have.
Yeah, most people don't have access to that.
Right. Well, let me ask you just what are some of the tipped wages coming to the forefront, but there are other issues that you work on with the restaurant opportunity centers. What are some of the preeminent other things that you think are important to know about the fight?
Yeah. There's really three key issues that workers continuously bring up. We surveyed at this point over 6,000 workers nationwide, and the same things keep emerging everywhere. The top is, of course, poverty wages, and especially the tip minimum wage. The second is this issue of mobility that you've already touched upon. And so we've really been looking at the issue of racial segregation and gender segregation in our industry. We've done hundreds of what's called match pair audit tests, where we send hundreds of pairs of white and people of color applicants into fine dining restaurants to see who gets hired. We found that white applicants have twice the chance of a person of color, even when the person of color has a better resume, you know, in getting one of these fine dining server positions. So we really need to be looking at the kind of training programs that we provide to allow workers of color to get into fine dining service positions. We need to be looking at policy that incentivizes employers to really promote from within and desegregate their restaurants. So that's the second big issue. And the third big issue is, of course, access to benefits, the lack of paid sick days. 90% of workers in this industry don't have a single earned sick day, which means they can't take a day off when they're sick, not just because they can't afford it, but often because they'll be penalized or fired for taking a day off when they're sick, which has tremendous public health implications for all of us as consumers. Also, the lack of access to healthcare, even post-healthcare reform in this country. Our industry really led the effort to form a club called the 29ers. I don't know if you or your listeners have heard about this, but Denny's and many other Darden, you know, which is Olive Garden, Capital Grille Steakhouse, formed a kind of association of companies that committed to basically reduce all of their workers' hours to 29, one less than 30, so that they wouldn't be eligible to participate in the exchanges or be part of healthcare reform. So many of our workers at this moment are falling through the cracks, perhaps because they're immigrants and can't get access to healthcare reform, perhaps for other reasons. So there's still a tremendous lack of healthcare for our people, and both the lack of paid sick days and the lack of healthcare has really horrendous consequences for our public health as consumers.
Let me just ask you finally, is there something you'd like to see more of or less of in terms of media coverage of this set of issues?
Yeah, I really appreciate that question. I really hope that the media can cover this issue of tipping in a more nuanced way, that really understand that the first step has to be eliminating the lower wage for tipped workers, and that has to be the focus. You know, I think talking about tipping more broadly is sexy and people like to talk about it, but when people are living on literally slave wages of $2.13 an hour and that it is an actual legacy of slavery, we need to, as a nation, first demand that this industry eliminate this legacy of slavery, and then we can talk about the elimination of tipping. We can support restaurants moving in this direction, however they're doing it. I really hope that the media can make that distinction between those two issues, and in supporting restaurants and profiling restaurants that are moving in this direction, really highlight those that are doing it right, like Danny Meyer, who did it in a very transparent way and has committed to actually ensuring that without tips, his workers are going to make the same thing in wages that they would have made in tips. That's what we would want to see of anybody following. So we know a lot of restaurants are going to jump on this bandwagon of eliminating tipping. And if we all understand that the most important thing is what are workers actually being paid, then it shouldn't be about tips or no tips. It should be about determining what is a restaurant actually paying their workers.
We've been speaking with Saru Jayaraman of the Restaurant Opportunity Centers United and the Food Labor Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley. Her upcoming book is Forked, A New Standard for American Dining. Saru Jayaraman, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website, FAIR.org. The website is also the place to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network or to subscribe to our newsletter, Extra. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock. Last week's program, Facing the Harsh Realities of Now with David Wasdell, set records for radio and listeners on SoundCloud. If you missed it, don't. David Wasdell makes his case that we are already committed to at least 6 degrees C of global warming, plus dozens of meters higher seas. Grab it from my website at ecoshock.org or listen at soundcloud.com/radioecoshock. This week, I've got a broad mix for you. Courtney White says we can capture carbon back into the soil, even if only 2% of the population act on it. We'll talk new science with Justin Mankin, how disappearing snow cover will impact people around the world. We wrap with octogenarian activist and author Peter Seidel, saying, yes, we do still have time. Before we get to our guests, dozens of listeners wrote in saying they were dismayed by the damning climate revelations by David Wasdell. While I agree with David that our true situation has been downplayed by governments, by media, and misplaced scientific caution, I also try to keep balance. You may want to consider three more ideas. First, the very high temperatures and sea levels David describes would likely only be attained in a few hundred years from now. That might give us time to develop ways and technologies to drastically reduce greenhouse gases. We might manage to cut greenhouse gas levels, say, to 280 parts per million, as was the case in pre-industrial days. If we do, some glaciers would still melt, because once they start, they're hard to stop. So we would still get sea level rise. The oceans would continue to give off residual heat for a long time. However, temperatures could start to decline decade by decade. By then, of course, the world and all living creatures would be greatly changed, I think. Second, in the coming week or two, I hope to present some other points of view and possible reasons to hope. You'll hear some of those voices in this program. Third, keep in mind that some scientists, including climate scientists, disagree with David's conclusions. Wise as he is, David is not officially a climate scientist. His high sensitivity figures can be disputed. I'm still looking into that. But yes, I found Wasdell's interview rather crushing. I'm still mulling it over, as we all must. Meanwhile, thank you for joining us, and on with the show. You know carbon is already too high in the atmosphere for our own climate safety, and perhaps you've heard the biggest and best solution is to put carbon back in the soil. But what are we supposed to do? Go shovel carbon into the lawn after work? Our next guest says organic carbon capture is maybe not a job for most of us, although we can help. In June 2014, I asked author and activist Courtney White about his book, Soil, Grass, and Hope. Now he's back with a collection of inspiring stories which point to fundamental answers. It's called 2% Solutions for the Planet. From Santa Fe, New Mexico, Courtney White. Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. I'm very happy to be here.
Just before we get to a whole slew of ideas for saving a living planet, how can you say just 2% of the population may be the key climate solvers?
Well, the book covers a number of practices that involve agriculture, ecological restoration, and things like that. And the 2% of the American population that could be the workforce for that is largely farmers and ranchers. And I think most folks don't realize that most of the food in this country is produced by just a tiny fraction of our population. So that was the idea behind that part of the 2%.
Yeah, it used to be about 50% way back in the day were, you know, farming and on the land. I wonder, wouldn't that number have to go up if we stop using so much fossil fuels and machinery?
Oh, yeah. And if we do a lot of the things that are in the book, folks who are not farmers and ranchers can help out as well. We have lots of ecological restoration that can be done. There's lots of jobs out there potentially for those kinds of works. Anything renewable energy, as we all know about. I mean, there's the potential for a lot of activity, a lot of jobs and paychecks, kind of related to this idea of 2% solutions. It's not just about food.
But I think the rest of us could be still carbon grabbers if we demanded carbon capture from the food we buy. I mean, wouldn't it be great, Courtney, to see labels saying how much greenhouse gas was either added or subtracted by the product you're about to buy?
Yeah, and that's actually a very important part of the puzzle here. And I know folks are working on this. There's some complications about how to quantify and measure soil carbon, but they're figuring that out. And we know what the practices are that do this work. So when we can kind of connect those dots, you'll start to see some kind of labeling certification type process to let the consumer, the eater or the energy user, know what the farmer ranch is doing in terms of carbon capture and sequestration in soils.
What do you think of Alan Savory's claims of returning carbon to the soil by raising meat animals differently?
Well, yeah. So I have a chapter, I have a couple profiles in the book that look at ranching and cattle and regenerative agriculture kind of through the lens of grazing practices. And, we've known Alan for many years. A lot of the ranchers we work with use some variation on the principles that he thought of first way back when. And this is the idea to graze domesticated animals in patterns or behavior that mimic nature, the way that nature wants grazing animals to move and herd and bunch up and move along. And there's an old saying in organic agriculture that nature never farms without animals, which is, I think, a really great way of looking at this. So in nature, there are herbivores grazing and going. So they graze and they go. That's bison, antelope, pronghorn, even rabbits and, everything. So Alan Savory came up with a very smart insight that if we patterned domesticated herbivores, cows in this case, sheep or goats, on patterns of behavior that mimic nature, graze and go, this will be good for the land, good for grass, good for plant vigor, roots going down, carbon being sequestered. And over 40 years, he and the ranchers who use a lot of his ideas have demonstrated these systems work. And I've seen that firsthand. So fundamentally, we can store carbon in soils by getting grass, rangelands, grasslands, healthier, more vigorous, with deeper roots, and then a lot of carbon through photosynthesis goes down through those grass plants and into the soil. So that's a long answer to your question, which is that he's right.
Well, one of the concerns I have is how long does carbon stay in grassland soil? Is it a good long-term solution, or is it a fast, shorter-term fix?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it's just a little bit complicated. If you dug a hole into a lawn or a grasslands, right at the very top of where the grass plants are, there's a lot of biological activity, a lot of microbes and nematodes and all that kind of stuff. And the carbon cycle at that point is very active, so a lot of carbon is going out of plants into that layer. But microbes digest carbon and they burp CO2. It's called respiration. So that cycle is quick, and you can get a lot of CO2 coming out of microbes as a consequence. But farther down the profile, the deeper the hole that you dug and farther down you go, there's less microbial activity. So if you can get plants to put roots down and then the carbon comes out of the roots into the soil, it's kind of a complicated process, that storage is much longer term. In fact, the farther down that profile you go, you can get hundreds of years of storage as long as we don't disturb that soil, as long as it's not plowed, for example, and turned over. So there's not a lot of carbon storage in the top layer. But farther down, there's potentially a lot of storage for long periods of time. And that's our chore, is to get that carbon down that plant by making the plant happy, right? So it's got water, it's got sunlight, it's got good soils, so it grows. And as it grows, it puts deeper roots down past that active layer at the top. So it's a little complicated, but it's the bottom line is let's have happy, healthy, green plants doing our carbon sequestration for us.
Well, you went way beyond ranching when you got this new book out, and you write about edible forests, for example, and aquaponics. It got me wondering, did you go out and find people who are actually doing this successfully?
Yeah, I mean, some of the stories I knew, some of the stories I heard as I traveled about, some of the stories I researched, having read about them in other contexts. And for your listeners, the book looks at 50 different profiles, 50 different ways of producing food or water regeneratively. So they all have a kind of a climate connection, but they do it in lots of different ways. So there's a section on farming, a section on ranching, there's a section in the middle on technology, meaning appropriate technology for this, and there's a section on ecological restoration, and then finally on wildness, on wild animals, because I'm a conservationist by background, and I don't want to leave wild animals out of this. It can't be about agriculture all the time. So I knew some of those stories. Some I'd heard about. I had to go sit down and research, like dung beetles. I'd heard about dung beetles, that the power of the dung beetle in ecosystems. But until I sat down and did a lot of research about dung beetles, I didn't know the details.
What is FarmHack, and could our listeners get involved?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. FarmHack was started by a group of farmers in New Hampshire, led by Doran Cox, who's a farmer near Lee, New Hampshire. And Doran is a very interesting – he's in Grass Soil Hope, which is the carbon book that I wrote. He left the farm. He went into software, into tech, learned all about that, came back to the farm, and decided that they wanted to create a forum, an online forum for new ranchers and farmers to talk to each other. It's kind of a virtual cafe. They call it Farm Hack, and hacking being a common term in the software universe. And the idea is that it's a forum, so folks can kind of log on, ask questions. And he was trying to help young farmers not have to reinvent the wheel every time when they start farming, but also any farmer that's got a question, there's a face-to-face part of this. They have workshops, they meet up and do things, but it's a way of sharing. It's open source, the whole kind of open source commons idea. Let's share information. Let's don't make it proprietary. And so anybody who's listening, is interested, can certainly log on. Go to farmhack.net, I think it is, and you got to create an account and go on. But it's the wonderful thing about the internet is that it's an open book, so to speak, for anybody who wants to participate. And this is a good example of how new technology serves old technology. So in this case, organic farming meets the internet.
And tell us just about a couple of climate-friendly or planet-friendly solutions you found in other countries.
Yeah, you bet. One, for example, that I mentioned in Grass Soil Hope was this research project in France done by some French scientists where they put solar panels above farm fields. And what they're trying to do is, and Europe has a lot of space issues. They need to be very efficient about how they produce food and energy. In this case, the scientists said, let's produce renewable energy and healthy food from the same plot of land. And so they put these solar panels above these farm fields and then did all the calculations to make sure that they could maximize energy production while producing healthy food. And that's a very good example of how new technology can meet old technology, and it shades the plants on hot days and all those kinds of things. And I thought, what a cool idea. And that's an example from France. There's a lot going on in Australia. I talk about pasture cropping, which is a way of growing an annual crop in a perennial pasture, like oats in a grassland, which comes from Australia. Another farmer down there puts his cattle and his sheep together into one unit. Usually they're kept apart, sheep and cows kept apart. In this case, he put them together. He likes the way they graze together. Their impact, he calls it a flurd, a herd and a flock together, called a flurd. And this is very unusual. not many farmers or ranchers are willing to combine sheep and cattle together. So those are three examples from overseas. I just picked 50, and there's a lot more out there. A lot of stuff going on, a lot of innovation, which is, I think, very exciting.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest from the Kivira Coalition, Courtney White. Courtney, what does Kivira mean?
So Kivira is an old Spanish colonial word to describe unknown territory. So I live in New Mexico, and when the Spanish came exploring way back when, Kivira was a word that they wrote on the map. So it just meant unknown territory over the hill. And when I started Kivira with a rancher and another conservationist trying to find common ground between ranchers and environmentalists, we felt like we were heading off into this unknown territory, so we decided to use Kivira. It doesn't really mean anything. It's just a name the Spanish wrote on their maps for land beyond the horizon.
It's a beautiful word. I'm going to use it. So now, your title, 2% Solutions, it has two other meanings. First of all, talk to us about the 2% of carbon that needs to go back to the soil.
Right, yeah. So if anybody who's listening is a gardener, you know that the soil in your garden, that dark, rich soil that is productive and healthy, most of that's carbon. A lot of it's carbon, the element, C. And it doesn't need a lot of carbon. So a lot of land has, 2%, 3%, 4%, 5% carbon is in the soils. So the 2% solution here is if we could double the soil carbon from 2% to 4%, or just add 2% to the soil, all of these benefits flow. So it's, it holds more water, plants are more productive, and that kind of stuff. For just a little bit of carbon, you get all of this benefit done by 2% of the population, which is farmers and ranchers, for only 2% of the GDP. And that's just a number I grabbed because the point is that these practices described in the book are very cheap, by and large. It doesn't require a lot of money. So for a little bit of money, for a little bit of carbon done by a few people, you can have tremendous benefits for climate, for food, for water, for jobs, all kind of wrapped up in this regenerative agriculture that is going on right now.
Okay, let's say a country decides as national policy to develop carbon-friendly agriculture. There's going to be some economic dislocation as current producers perhaps lose share and new ways of farming are brought up to scale. How can we pay for that and how much would it cost?
Yeah, those are good questions. We have an industrial food system that depletes carbon, doesn't add carbon. So getting farmers and ranchers paid for increasing or storing more carbon would require kind of a rethinking of our economic system. I'm not sure that it would displace many farmers and ranchers, at least not folks that I know. So if you can get them to change their practices to regenerative instead of degenerative agriculture, the question is how do you pay them? They would get a benefit from productivity, in their land, but ultimately we're going to have to figure out some sort of carbon payment system. It'd be nice to have it linked to a carbon tax, meaning that we tax carbon that we burn. That pool of money, which would help us reduce emissions, that amount of money could be available for farmers and ranchers and other folks to increase carbon in soils. So there's a nice link there. Create a pot of money, spend it to pay ranchers and farmers to do more. It's not hard to measure. So I fantasize someday that we have a system that would pay folks. You could measure it, double the soil carbon, you get paid for it somehow. More dislocation in mentally in our paradigms, how we look at the world than anything else. We'd have to probably do away with feedlots and all that terrible stuff, but that's okay in the long run. So the point of the book is that these practices exist. They've been out there for a while. They've been beta tested. They're practical. They're profitable. We don't have to invent anything. We don't have to wait for new technology. It's all ready. But as you say, we need to figure out how to pay the landowner and the manager to do this work.
Of course, you've mentioned the awful word tax, and the conservatives will object to subsidizing carbon capture and agriculture, but isn't every major food-producing country already pouring vast amounts into agricultural subsidies?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And So, you know, the tax question, you know, I understand. I mean, nobody wants their taxes raised. Things cost enough as it is. But we have a system that's taking us in a dangerous direction, and climate and carbon pollution. And at some point, we're going to have to figure this out. And I don't know if tax is the right word, or if you do it through credits, or what. But we have to figure out a way to get that carbon economy going. And to say that we can't raise taxes, well, I understand, but then where does that money come from, at least initially, until we start paying for more stuff? So that, you know, that's beyond my pay grade, you know, in terms of how to make this work at the kind of the tax policy level. But I just know that the practices are there. They've been vetted. They exist. They produce all these benefits, food, water, healthy animals, health space protection. It's a win-win-win-win-win all the way down the line. If it means that we pay more, either through the cost of services, the food, or through a tax thing, and it seems to me at this point we got to bite that bullet in order to get the world that we want.
Well, we might save the $60 billion we're going to have to pay every time New York gets hit by yet another storm and rising seas. So look, in your book, you have a great story about a farmer who became dejected about his role in harming the planet. Just tell us briefly about that, would you?
Yeah, you bet. His name is John Gosney. He lives in Oklahoma. I went out there to see a very innovative model of food distribution called the Oklahoma Food Cooperative. And it's an internet-based way to buy food across Oklahoma. And this is a challenge for farmers and ranchers that are remote. How do they get to markets? And it was a very cool way of kind of linking eaters to producers. But he was part of the tour, and I went to his ranch, and he told this amazing story. He'd been a chemical farmer, meaning he'd farmed, raised his cattle and done his sheep with lots of pesticides and chemicals and things. And he didn't feel well. He knew it was bad for the land, and he frankly had just gotten depressed. And he told the group that his life changed entirely when a neighbor who wanted to retire asked him to take over their organic wheat farm. And he had not thought about this, and he was resistant, and he said okay. And he went and he studied it and realized it was a good idea. So he converted his farm to organic, which means he got rid of all the chemicals. He felt better physically, and as he told the group I was with, he felt like he was doing God's work now after all this time. And he was a farmer to the bone, and he loves the land, but he wants it to be healthy, not depleting, and that's what happened to him. He got excited again through the converting to an organic farm, and his depression went away, and he had motivated again, and he really felt like he was a new person. It was a very moving story that I've heard other farmers and ranchers explain, like get off pesticides, get on to healthy practices, good for people and land. They feel better.
It's like getting off heroin almost.
Yeah, you know. And, of course, now they have a lot of science behind all this stuff, meaning that they know what these pesticides are doing to us. And from kids and embryos on up to adults, this stuff is toxic, and it's toxic on a lot of levels. And now, if finally we're seeing a lot of the kind of research come out and say, even in small amounts, this stuff. So then this stuff goes into the food, and if you eat industrial wheat, it goes into you. It's an old saying, if it's in the feed, it's in the food, meaning it's in you. So your listeners, I mean, the way to try to support all this is to ask careful questions about what you eat. Where is it from? What's in it? Could you eat from a farm or a ranch that is carbon friendly? But not just organic, but is it doing, energy things, carbon things? There's not a lot out there. There's more than there used to be, but there's more on the way.
Can you talk to us about any recent conferences or organizations that inspire you?
Well, yes. And what's sort of amazing about the last 3, 4, 5 years is that there's a lot more conferences, a lot more ways to go and learn about this. I don't go back east a lot. There's a lot of conferences out here. There was a conference in California just in September called Soil, Not Oil. It drew a lot of people. Again, the idea that let's think about soil, let's get off oil. There's an annual Bioneers conference in San Francisco in October. It's in its 26th year. It's a great place to go learn about these alternatives. There's lots of ecological farming conferences. There's one in February called Moses in Wisconsin. I know there's a lot of stuff back east. Stone Barns in New York has a big conference. I think if listeners are interested, just Google Ecological Agriculture Conference and see what comes up.
As we wrap up, is there anything I've missed or a final message you would like to leave, particularly with our city listeners?
So there's two messages. One, why I wrote the book is I want folks to feel like there's an alternative to our current food and energy systems. You know, we get the industry is controlled by the big boys, the big dogs, that don't want us to know that organic and regenerative agriculture can answer our problems. This was a way of kind of showing that we can. And number two is an antidote to despair. There are big problems out there. We tend to get gloomy about our prospects. I wanted folks to know that there are things on the ground that can be done right now. And if listeners who live in the city, I would encourage them just to seek them out. I mean, there's a story about a rooftop farm in Brooklyn and energy and watershed stuff. And these things can happen almost anywhere around you. Just kind of dig a little bit and see where you can participate.
We've been talking with Courtney White. He dropped out of the Sierra Club as a conflict industry to found the nonprofit Kivira Coalition, which is dedicated to bringing together many players for planetary solutions. You can find out more at kiviracoalition.org, and that is spelled Q-U-I-V-I-R-A. I'll also put links to Courtney's new book, 2% Solutions for the Planet, in my show blog at ecoshock.info. The subtitle is 50 Low-Cost, Low-Tech, Nature-Based Practices for Combating Hunger, Drought, and Climate Change. Courtney, thank you so much for joining us again on Radio EcoShock.
Appreciate it, Alex, and thank you so much.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock, beaming the real eco truth out to the world. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening in. Now it's time to talk with a leading climate scientist. Last summer, the river in my little valley displayed its bottom for the first time. No one living can remember seeing it, and it wasn't really a lack of rain, it was the thin covering of snow in the mountain headwaters. On a warming planet, it makes sense we'll get less snow, but few of us have really worked out what that could mean around the world. A multinational team of crack scientists just released the paper, The Potential for Snow to Supply Human Water Demand in the Present and Future. It's not looking good. From the Columbia University Earth Institute and affiliated with NASA, we have Dr. Justin Mankin on the line. Justin, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thanks for having me.
As you can tell, Justin, I have a vested interest in getting enough snow, and that's a strange concern for a Canadian, let me tell you. What happened to the snowpack in the mountains of California this past year?
This past year in California, we saw near record lows in Sierra Nevada snowpack. There are lots of facts and figures that get thrown around about the actual amount of California's water availability that originates with Sierra snowpack. We know enough to know that it's a large fraction of California's water demand that's by such snowpack. And we know that the transition in places like California from being a snow-dominated regime up in the mountainous regions to being, say, a rainfall-dominated regime, has some pretty big consequences, not just for people, but for ecosystems as well.
Is declining snowfall just a problem on the west coast of North America?
No, it doesn't appear to be. I mean, certainly as you noted in your introduction, we know that in general, a warmer world is going to mean that freezing elevations are going to increase in a lot of places. And if you can imagine kind of climbing up a mountain, you know that as you get higher and higher towards the peak, there's less surface area over which snow could accumulate. So increasing freezing elevations, right? This is the kind of the altitude at which you'd have a phase transition from rainfall to snowfall. Those are going to increase in the future in a lot of locations. The complication here is that we know that it's this kind of subannual mix of temperature variability and precipitation variability that kind of determines whether or not precipitation falls as rain or falls as snow. And further, we know that there are going to be places that benefit, and I use benefit in quotes here, meaning they have the potential for increased snow on multi-decadal timescales because we know that a warmer atmosphere holds more moisture. And so places that still remain below freezing in winter times are going to have more moisture in the air, which if it precipitates will fall as snow. So, you know, the complication here is this subannual mix of temperature variability and precipitation variability. But then there's a whole host of physics that are really quite complicated that determine how long snow stays on the ground for and the extent to which it accumulates. And those things are pretty challenging. And so what we really tried to do in this study you referenced in your introduction is identify, we have a pretty good sense of what's going to happen with global warming, that snowpacks are going to reduce, but the implications of that snow response, even if it's varied from place to place, say potential increases versus potential decreases, the implications of that response is going to be a function not simply of the supply of snow, but how it's demanded and used. And so what we try to identify is where in the world people are reliant on snow in the present climate, and then examine the potential of a future climate snow and changes in rainfall to supply present demand as well. And we identify in the 421 basins that we kind of demarcated in the Northern Hemisphere, we found that there are about 97 basins in the present climate that really need snow to fulfill human water demand.
Now, I'm presuming we're talking about long-term trends here. In these times of extreme weather, could there not still be the odd year where record snow shows up, maybe even this year?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, we're already beginning to see that in California. And, you know, and this is one of the things that's really challenging, not just in kind of estimating how snow is going to change in the future, but communicating how it's going to change in the future, and by extent, helping to prepare water managers for what the kind of varied forms a world with global warming can take. So we're already seeing that because of a phenomenon in the Pacific Ocean, in the tropical Pacific Ocean called El Nino. It's essentially just a mass of warm water that has piled up off the eastern Pacific, eastern tropical Pacific. And that happens on timescales of, say, every 2 to 7 years or so. And this year, the temperature anomaly in the eastern Pacific is actually quite high, and that has typically, really strong El Nino events have typically been associated with pretty wet California winters. And this year, we're seeing a really strong El Nino event, and it's already beginning to have some of its attendant or associated consequences. And so there was a really large snowfall event in this year in Nevada earlier. But again, this is kind of a one-year event, and the California drought has been going on for 4 years, and we know that the four-year deficit, we would need to have a pretty tremendous year from kind of a snowpack perspective and from a kind of a wet California winter perspective to really make up that prolonged four-year deficit that we're seeing in California. And with and kind of hoping for an extremely wet California winter can come with it a whole host of other challenges, such as the kind of need to manage flood risks and landslides and those types of events as well. So the point being that an extremely wet California winter won't make up the deficits that have accumulated over the last 4 years.
Now, it seems to me the snowpack is almost like a reservoir where the dam is really just time. So I'm wondering, it may seem like a stupid question, but are we really getting less snow, or is it just melting faster and earlier?
Right. That's a great point. So there's kind of a couple of features that are happening, right? So we know with increased warming, according to our best model projections, that the fraction of precipitation that falls as snow in many northern hemisphere regions during winter will decline. That's a pretty robust estimate. So more often than not, the temperatures during winter will not be cold enough for snow to fall, and instead precipitation that in a past climate formerly fell as snow will fall as rain. So that's kind of on net less snow even falling out of the sky. And for many places, even in places that might see snowfall increases, and here's kind of another complication, in places that might see snowfall increases, precipitation increases in general are also expected, and those snowfall increases may be outpaced by rainfall increases. Those snowfall increases may be outpaced by rainfall increases. So still, the fraction of precipitation falling as snow would decline. We also know that the snow that does accumulate, there will still be snow that accumulates, but there will be less accumulating, and it will melt early in the season and change runoff regimes quite drastically in a lot of different places. And the fact of the matter is that if you just look at a map of the Northern Hemisphere in the heart of winter, just a huge fraction of Northern Hemisphere landmass is covered by snow, and that kind of intimates that all the complicated ways that ecosystems in particular are really tied snow to snow's accumulation. You know, for forest ecosystems, for example, there are numerous studies that point to the fact that snow cover provides a layer of insulation on the ground, protecting vulnerable root structures and forest ecosystems, that it also helps kill pests that try to overwinter and cause a lot of the forest diebacks, such as we're seeing in the northwestern United States. So as winter is warm, beetles, for example, bark beetles, will tend to be able to survive those cold winters. The other feature of it is that, you know, come spring, a lot of riparian and forest ecosystems rely on the fact that snow pulses off a tremendous amount of nutrients in addition to water. And that feature is really critical, and I think one that a lot of researchers are beginning, a lot of ecologists are exploring the implications of that. So you're absolutely right that snow, it's not just on net a change in the amount of snow that accumulates on the ground, but also the timing of the runoff regime, and therefore kind of the phenology in a lot of these ecosystems, and then just kind of the cadence of human water demand. I mean, in a lot of these, if you were to just look at it, say an annual climatology, a monthly climatology of human water demand in the San Joaquin Basin and rainfall, you would see that, you know, human water demand begins to peak around March and April. It kind of starts to and heads up to a peak in the heart of summer. And that's precisely when precipitation is at its lowest in the basin. And so there's this mismatch between what's demanded when and what's provided by the atmosphere. And snow is this tremendous kind of natural infrastructure that regulates water availability during those months of atmospheric shortfall.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith talking with scientist Justin Mankin about disappearing snowpacks. Justin, was your group able to calculate how many people in the world depend at least partly on snowpack as a source of agricultural, irrigation, or drinking water?
Yeah, I mean, we provide an estimate, and I'm happy to give it. In the 97 basins that we identify as being snow-dependent, there are currently about 1.9 billion people that live in those basins presently based on 2015 population estimates. And I think it's important to really flesh out what I mean by snow dependent. We can't go back in time and say this water molecule, which was transpired by this agricultural crop in this valley, originated a snowpack in this in this mountain pass. And this water molecule originated as rainfall and was used in this industrial process. So that's something we can't do. What we can do is we can identify places where snowmelt runoff is a part of the hydrological regime within a river basin. That is, that on seasonal scales, accumulates snow, and then that snow melts and provides water availability to the basin. And at the same time, we can identify those basins where rains in spring and summer are insufficient to fulfill all human water demands. And so what we can then do is kind of give a bulk scale characterization of the fraction of the leftover demand after removing the amount that could be supplied by spring and summer rains. This demand needs to be fulfilled by some other source. And there are lots of different ways that humans have devised to ensure water availability during these months of shortfall, typically in spring and summer when demands are at their highest. And snow is one of them. Groundwater pumping is another. The building of storage reservoirs is a third. So there are a number of strategies in place to ensure water availability. And what we're identifying here is the potential that snow has had in the present climate to supply that demand that's left over. So you can imagine for any one of these basins, there's going to be a constellation of policies, of management practices that are going to ensure water availability during those months of shortfall. And snow is among them. And what we're identifying here is the places where snow has had a unique potential to supply this leftover demand, this demand that would be unmet by spring and summer rains, and therefore where management practices might need to change in a future climate based on the risks we identify of decreases.
Where are some of the most sensitive bases outside of California that are threatened with declining snow and water supplies?
So there are kind of two factors that we're really looking at here. There's changes in snowmelt runoff, which is something that we expect. But at the same time, I noted earlier that a warmer atmosphere is going to hold more moisture. So we expect a lot of places to have increases in rainfall at the same time that we would expect them to have decreases in snowmelt runoff. And so a kind of a critical quandary here is the extent to which this increase in rainfall, if people had the means to capture and use it productively, to what extent could these increases in rainfall actually offset some of the losses from snowmelt runoff decreases? And so what we tried to do is to take that into account moving into the future. And the places that are at greatest risk are those locations where you expect both decreases in snowmelt runoff and decreases in rainfall runoff. So they're kind of doubly affected over the spring and summer months when demand tends to be highest. And there are non-trivial likelihoods in a lot of basins, including in the American West, the North American West, including on the Iberian Peninsula and the Italian Peninsula and parts of the Middle East and Anatolian Peninsula and Turkey. There are also a number of basins in the Caucasus and in Central Asia that do also have some non-trivial likelihoods nearly of decreases in both rainfall runoff and snowmelt runoff. Just from a snowmelt perspective, there are a large number of basins that have over 90% risk that we identify as having potential increases, and those are similar basins to the ones I just named. So from a 90% risk perspective, Sacramento, the San Joaquin, the Rio Grande, the Atlas Basin in East Africa, Northeast Africa, Iberian Peninsula, parts of the Italian Peninsula, and around the Aegean Basin. You know, what's actually quite interesting is that the Indus Basin we identify as having a pretty low risk of decreases in our measure of water availability, and that's because the increases in rainfall runoff really compensate the decreases in snowmelt runoff. And so this kind of highlights another really important point that I intimated at earlier, which is that our measure is capturing this interaction between snowmelt runoff and rainfall runoff and its ability to supply spring and summer human water demand. And so in a future climate, if what was formerly accumulating as snow is now falling as rain, that presents a really different management challenge to people because people need to be in a position to capture and use that water. Otherwise, it will just run off to the ocean. The great thing about snow is that it kind of releases water concurrent with some of these increases in demand. And so our kind of ability to identify, to parse that out for different locations that we identify as, say, having equivocal risks, meaning that there are not decreases in our measure of water availability, we'll have to be in a position to respond to this transition from a solid precipitation regime, i.e. snowfall, to one that's a liquid-dominated one, i.e. rainfall. And that isn't captured by our analysis.
Well, climate change is so inconvenient, and it doesn't help that this complex planet is hard for humans to grasp at all. Your science, I think, has contributed to it. We've been talking with Justin Mankin, lead author of the new paper, The Potential for Snow to Supply Human Water Demand in the Present and Future. You can find links for Justin and this paper in my weekly Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. Justin, thank you so much for finding the time to talk with us.
Oh, happy to do it. Thanks, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
Our next guest was an architect who published designs for ecologically sound cities starting in 1968 and for a model eco-city in the Cincinnati area in the 1970s. Like many who offer technical solutions, over the years, Peter Seidel's books began to ask, what is wrong with us? Why can't we adopt obvious answers to serious problems? His 1998 book, for example, was Invisible Walls: Why We Ignore the Damage We Inflict on the Planet and Ourselves. Apparently, Peter Seidel hasn't given up yet. His latest book is titled There Is Still Time. Peter Seidel, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, I'm glad to be with you, Alex.
Just the other day, you know, I admit I considered giving up on this radio show. I thought humans are not capable of solving the problems we create. Do you feel that frustration, Peter?
Well, I feel it, but we've got to. We've got to do it. And I think there are ways to work our way through it. No magic bullets, but there are things we can do. And if we work hard at them and look for, you know, places to, wedges to get into and to push, I think we can accomplish some things.
All right. Well, let me tell you the story of a friend of mine, Jack Alpert. He was working at General Motors in the 1960s. He found the major cause of death in car accidents was people being thrown through the windshield. So as an engineer, Jack invented seatbelts, and they worked. But he was horrified when people would not wear them until decades of tickets and fines later. So what is it about human nature that even when we have a solution, we don't act to save our own lives?
That is a very good question. That is something we've really got to work on very hard. I mean, the fact is, I observe that what you're saying is true. We've got to deal with it, and we've got to find out better reasons of why we don't.
Well, I wonder if it isn't because we're absorbed with our own personal lives and can't get beyond that. I just did a show on a tremendous climate disaster in Indonesia, but it didn't reach as many people as I think it needs to, and I guess people don't care about Indonesia. So somehow we've got to get global, and that doesn't seem to be in our nature.
We evolved to live as hunter-gatherers, and this was in a very small society, a very small group. And we had to care about what was right around us. If we actually cared about something that was happening way off, a leopard might jump out of a bush and eat us. We had to care about what was right around us. And so we have developed caring what's right around us now, in the present time, not thinking about the future. If we were thinking about the future, maybe something would happen. So we had to be fast and simple, and that's the way we think.
And you also talk about the emotional self. How does that affect our ability to solve these big problems?
Well, the emotional self is necessary because one thing, well, it got me to write this book, because you care. And because of that, the emotional self does a lot of good things. However, there's another aspect of it that is a real problem to deal with. For instance, every day there are 15,000 children die because of malnutrition. Now, who's moved by that? Hardly anyone. However, if they watch a television program and there's a little cute little dog gets hit by a car, they'll get all wrapped up in that. They might even send things to the station for the dog. And that way, the emotion right now that's close to us that they can feel somehow moves them. Whereas the reality of what's happening, of 15,000 children dying every day, doesn't strike them.
It is strange. And I wonder, though, how much our inability to solve problems may also be institutional. For example, do you think corporations and capitalism can really prevent a climate catastrophe?
There actually is not much incentive the way the corporation is set up. A corporation is set up for what? It's set up to basically to make money for its stockholders. That's its goal. And its stockholders are people who aren't thinking very much about the future. And they want their money now because if it doesn't make money, they're going to sell their stock and move on to buy something else. So a corporation just isn't set up, isn't organized to protect our future.
Yeah. So in a journal called Futures in 2009, you published a piece that puzzled me a little. I didn't have access to read it. It's called, Is It Inevitable That Evolution Self-Destruct? What was that about?
Well, it was a scenario. So I was asked to write a scenario about the end of civilization, the end of that. I didn't get the idea to do it. I was asked to do it. It's interesting. That's sort of the beginning of this whole thing, which led to this book. So I started thinking about it, and when you look into it, I saw that, well, maybe it's even inevitable that we're going to destroy ourselves. Because we do things, we're driven in a certain direction that do things that work in a way that don't work for our long-term good, but that evolution made us so that we work for our short-term good, what we need now. It did not make us to be concerned about our future and in concern about what we want right now here. We can do an awful lot of damage. And the conclusion of that is, when you think about it, it could actually lead to the destruction of civilization.
And you took another route to painting that predicament in your science fiction book called 2045, A Story of Our Future. Could you just give us a brief outlook of what's in that book?
What's in that book? Well, that book is really a story about what it would be like, putting in the form of a story, and that goes back to the emotional thing. Because when you present a lot of information about the future, people aren't as much moved by it. So I thought, well, let's try a novel. It doesn't work as what novel readers want because, first of all, they want to have a conflict on one of the first pages. It didn't have that. But it looked at a lot of things that are happening and projected where this was going, where it was headed. You know, you're talking just about corporations. There's more and more amalgamation and merging. And in this book, it ended up with 8 corporations, and they all moved on to a series of 3 different islands around the world where these 8 corporations had their headquarters. And these people associated each other with each other. They lived on these islands. They kept as much as they could away from, well, other people weren't allowed to come there and see how they lived. Well, anyhow, a series of things like that were things that were happening and projected into the future. Where could this lead? And that was one of the things that it led to. A lot of environmental things, of course, like global warming and spread of all kinds of things. One thing it had a huge factory in Senegal, I think, and it was a huge place where people were starving outside, and they'd go to this factory just because they get fed there. And once they went into this huge building, they never got out, except on a barge which would dump them into the ocean. And there they worked because they got fed. And there they produced cheap things, T-shirts, so on, which was cheaper than you could get any place else because these people were working for basically nothing.
Back to slavery. Well, I'm wondering, you know, we talked about evolution, and one feeble hope, and maybe a scary one, is that giant global computers could help us arrange our society to avoid the worst catastrophes. If we can't evolve in time, maybe we become computer-assisted. What do you think?
Well, one trouble there would be, I think that the corporations would grab hold of the computers and use it for what they want to use it for. And I think that's what would probably happen.
Yeah, or some power-mad politicians, a dictator or something. Who controls the controllers?
Well, there's big tie-up between politicians and the business. They work together.
So has your understanding of the problem and the solution changed with your new book called There Is Still Time?
That's an interesting question. I think probably not much, but it is looking for solutions. You know, what we can do. You know, it's assuming we're starting where we are right now. We're not starting where we were in 2045. We're starting now to see to deal with the problems that we have in hand. And it looks at us and pretty much exposes us for what we are. And I think that a lot of these things, if they become exposed, you know, like in the back of the book, I offer some solutions, and one of the solutions is, and the solutions I divide into two types. One thing that what humanity ought to do to survive on the planet, but we can see today what humanity is doing, and not doing very well. So the other is what really committed environmentalists can do, people who really want to do something. And some of the things that they could do is they could bring together important scientists and thinkers, and they could analyze things about, like, greed, you know, what makes people greedy, why are they like this, and expose them and publish this. Because we know, you know, that happiness, and this is printed over and over again, is not related to how much money you've got or this or that. You know, and there's a lot of these things to look into and publish and make it public. And I think some of these things could help.
Now, I know some Radio EcoShock listeners feel deep in their hearts that there is not still time. The infrastructure for a 5-degree hotter world is built. We don't show any signs of changing, and major ice sheets at the poles seem committed to melting. What makes you think, Peter Seidel, that there is still time?
Well, I don't know that there really is, but there still is time to do something. And what we can do, if we really got effective at it and worked on it, we could mitigate what's going to happen. In other words, would it lead to a total extinction and all of that, or is it something, whatever we do, I think that it's going to be a pretty rough world. It's going to be a lot hotter. There's going to be a lot less food. You can say there's going to be a lot more people. They keep breeding. But however, it just simply isn't going to be able to support all those people. But there's going to be a lot of people living in terrible misery. And somehow, you know, the human species could pull through. It may not. I don't know.
By my calculation, you should be arriving at age 89 this December. Why not just sit back and see what happens? What drives you to keep struggling with ways to save ourselves?
That's a good question. I think if people care, who of us is going to be alive 100 years from now? Not very many of us. But I think we've got to care about the world 100 years from now. If we're moral people, if we're ethical people, if these things matter to us.
Well, is there anything I've missed you'd like to tell our listeners?
I think we've got to try. We've got to work. And I do think that the people who are already committed to trying to do something have to work even harder. And I think they can. And Chapter 7 of my book comes up with suggestions of things that people who really want to do something and will do something, if they have some other ideas of what to do, what they can do. On my website, which is peterseidelbooks.com, there is a thing where you can add comments, and I welcome comments there. If people have ideas of what we can do, what environmentalists can do, because we can't expect that the general public is all of a sudden going to turn around and do something big. But people who care already can do more if they think that it will be effective. And I'd like to collect ideas on that and put that on my website and put them wherever I can. And in further, in their future editions of the book, to put it in there.
Okay, and that's S-E-I-D-E-L. So, obviously, we've been talking with Peter Seidel. His new book doesn't shy away from describing how serious, perhaps even deadly, our current overshoot and overloaded civilization is. But as the title says, Peter thinks there is still time and explains why we're hung up and how to do better. I'll put links to the book in my Radio EcoShock blog, published at ecoshock.info. Peter, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about this, something very deep on my heart, as you can see.
I'm Alex Smith reporting. Even as he approaches 90, Peter Seidel tries to stimulate action to save the ecosphere and the future. I admire that. At Radio EcoShock, I know we're in for difficult struggles ahead. But I hope we all can see that the last chapter has not yet been written, if there is a last chapter. The story of natural life on Earth is composed almost entirely of twists and surprises. I remain convinced there is a future, and we should try, and try again, to make it the best possible for all those who come after us. I'm Alex Smith. Be sure and check out the show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Thank you so much for listening and caring about your world.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast. In occupied East Jerusalem, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. Since the beginning of October, there have been sustained uprisings led by Palestinian youth across the West Bank and Gaza Strip against Israel's ongoing rights violations, killings, home demolitions, and policies of occupation. More than 80 Palestinians have been killed since October, dozens as a result of Israel's policy of summary execution encouraged by its top leaders. Joining us to talk about the current situation in occupied Palestine is our contributor, Budur Yusuf Hassan. Budur lives here in Jerusalem and is a law school graduate and writer. And we're so glad she's with us here today. Budur, welcome back to the Electronic Intifada podcast. It's great to finally meet you in person here in Palestine.
Thanks for hosting me, Nora.
So if you could start by giving us your personal analysis of what's been happening the last 7 weeks or so, in particular across Palestine, and how you see these uprisings being organized.
What has been happening can be classified as unprecedented, at least ever since the Second Intifada, both in terms of the numbers of people who are actually going to protest on a regular basis and the repression that Israel is having to employ in order to crush the uprising. And even though there have been calmer days and there have been varying degrees of violence, we can say that the uprising has been continuing ever since October, ever since the stabbing attack that Mohannad Halabi carried out in the Old City in Jerusalem. It's hard to speak of a solid organizations because many of the attacks are individual attacks that carried by individual by youth rebels both in Jerusalem and in the West Bank. But in terms of resistance, there is organized resistance movements that are organizing themselves without having to rely on the top leadership, neither the leadership of the PA or the leadership of any factions. And this is illustrated by the way people are defending themselves ever since Israel occupation forces are responding with attacks against families of resistance fighters, of families of martyrs. And we have seen this in Shafat refugee camp, for example, when the Israeli army tried to invade the camp early October, when communities inside the camp organized themselves to thwart the Israeli occupation forces and prevented them from carrying a home demolition. We have seen it in various villages in the West Bank that try to prevent Israeli occupation forces from demolishing family homes of families of the martyrs. We've seen this in the Qalandia refugee camps, in Hebron, in Nablus. It didn't succeed all the time, but it showed that this resistance, although its major mark is the individual attacks, it's also supported by a wide array of people from the Palestinian society. Even those who are not actively participating in the uprising, they see that something has to happen, that a change has to happen. Many say that this uprising is led by the Oslo generation. And it's true in a sense that most of the attackers are have been born either during the Oslo Accords or after that. And this is this generation that has a bit been demonized by the older generation that has been accused of not doing enough, of being co-opted by the consumerist mentality, by the NGO mentality. It's proved that, no, it hasn't. And it's the one that leading the uprising. It's the one that paying the highest prices. And it's the one that trying to push the other fractions of the Palestinian society, other people, other groups to actually join them. And it caught many people off guard. The Israeli occupation forces are surprised by the movement that happening in a sense that they didn't expect it to be as sustainable as it has been. And the leadership and even the more elitist groups of activists have been surprised because these people, many of them were thought not to be as politicized as the more prominent activists. But it's proved, you know, they have proved that they have loads of political maturity, that they are willing to sacrifice, that they are willing to relinquish the relative advantages that they have, because many of those participating in the protest come from good backgrounds and socially. Not many of them are students. Many of them have good work, have good jobs. All of them have amazing families and dreams and a bright future waiting ahead. Still, they are prepared to sacrifice all of this in order to do a change. They know that they might not liberate Palestine with knives and guns right now, mainly, or with stones, but they know that this situation, this status quo, cannot be sustained forever, and a change has to be created.
A few days ago, we were talking about how the media, the Western media, has been portraying these uprisings, and the youth in particular who are being self-organized and participating in them. And there's been a lot of talk about, like, well, you know, Palestinian youth have nothing to lose. And I know that you took issue with that. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about why you see that not being true.
Because it's empirically false. Let's start with this. Because if you talk, I had the privilege of talking with families of martyrs. And I say it's a privilege because you see, you get to know these people firsthand. You got to know what the kind of life that they have lived. For example, Muhannad Halabi was a bright student at Al-Quds University. He was a law student. He was very eloquent and articulate. And he definitely had many dreams. He probably dreamed of being a lawyer. But then he found that this whole system is corrupt and is inherently unjust. And he can't fight the occupation with legal means. So the only way he can, and resistance for Muhannad Halabi was the most legal thing that he could do. Diya Talahmi as well was a very handsome, beautiful, and successful young man who also was a student, a fellow student of Muhannad at Al-Quds University. And he had an incredible family, an incredibly loving family. But also he felt that he has to do something. He has to be part of the resistance. Baha Alayan from Jerusalem, he was a scout leader. He was a community organizer in Jabal al-Mukabbir. He had lots of dreams. He had his family also was, relatively speaking, was also in a good had a good economic situation compared to other people in Jabal al-Mukabbir. And many others, even those who come from very difficult social economic backgrounds, and because most of the people who are carrying out this uprising come from working class neighborhoods, either from in Jerusalem or in Hebron or in Ramallah, the Ramallah area. And all of these people have so much to lose. They have, and they love life. Every time their friends keep repeating to me that I've never known someone who loved life as much as this or that martyr. All of these people love life. And Palestinians don't have to repeat every single time that they love life. It should be obvious. Everyone loves life, and especially these people. But the natural thing to do, they feel, because they love life, because they love dignity and love freedom, and because they have, it's precisely because they have a lot to lose that they are taking this. They are not desperate. They are not just, it's not using the politics of frustration to explain what's happening doesn't give justice to the uprising. And if it's just been a frustrated guy here and frustrated guy there, this wouldn't have been sustained. And we wouldn't have seen these uprisings repeat itself time and time again. And what's important to know that even though many of the guys carrying out individual attacks or going to protest, not all of them might be factional or belong to a political faction. Some do belong to a political faction, like Diya Talahmi, like Muhannad Halabi, and others. But some do not belong to political factions, but that doesn't mean that they are apolitical. Many of them are politicized. Many of them have been politicized because of the occupation, because of the Israel's encroachment upon their rights. And many of them have grown more politicized because of their daily participation in protests. This is how political involvement is created. These people are participating in protests and are carrying out individual attacks against Israeli occupation forces because they want to reclaim their agency, because they want to enter, be involved in mass politics, because they want to feel like they are part of the decision-making that have been taken away from them. The media shouldn't take away their agency by claiming that they have nothing to lose or by claiming that they are apolitical. Because at the time when they, all that they are doing is try to reclaim their agency and get back and be and feel that they are significant and feel that they are the one who are taking decisions, not just unelected officials doing things and deciding their future for them.
You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. Visit us online at electronicintifada.net or follow us on Twitter at Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada. Intifada
Electronica. Intifada
Electronica. The Electronic Intifada.
We're speaking with Badur Hassan here in occupied East Jerusalem at the Jerusalem Hotel and Cafe. Badur, Israeli forces have stormed Palestinian hospitals in the West Bank. They've arrested hundreds of people, including young children, and demolished many homes, especially here in East Jerusalem, as Israeli politicians vow even more racist and murderous policies day by day. Tell us about the incitement at the top levels of government here and Israel's plans for Jerusalem in particular, how that fits into the picture here.
We always hear that the Israelis claiming that Palestinian leaders are the one inciting to violence. But what actually is the truth is that Israeli officials are inciting to violence. And it's important to say that it's not just the right-wing fascists who are doing that. It's all parts of the Israeli political spectrum, the so-called from the so-called left to the far right are doing the incitement, including the Labour Party leaders, including everyone. It's the only difference is the tone with which they are speaking. Just a few weeks ago, the Israeli security cabinet decided that all homes of Palestinians who are accused of carrying out attacks against Israelis should be demolished. They vowed not to hand back corpses of martyrs to their families. We hear continuous talk about people who live in areas behind the Israeli apartheid wall that they will be denied of their Jerusalem residency. And these are not just threats. By the way, these threats have always been made. It's not the first time that Israeli officials are threatening with taking out the residency of people who live behind the wall. And we are talking about 100,000 people who live there. It's not the first time, but they are using these events in order to further support this move and legitimize it. Not that they need to do that, but at least in the eyes of the international community. And what Israeli officials have done really successfully, I'd say, is exploit the terrorist attacks we've seen in Europe in order to legitimize and in order to somehow link these terrorist attacks with what's happening in Palestine. Although there is absolutely no way you can compare anti-colonial violence that Palestinians are waging against an Israeli occupation force with the terrorist violence that the Islamic State, for example, is carrying out in Europe. But Israel has done that. Yesterday's move of the cabinet to officially declare the northern branch of the Islamic movement in Israel as an illegal and outlawed organization is just further proof of that, because it came a few days after the Paris attacks. And actually, Israeli officials are unashamedly saying that the Islamic movement, for instance, are calling for an Islamic caliphate, which is absolutely not true. Some Israeli officials, an army spokesperson, even claimed that an ISIS flag was raised in Hebron. Although, Palestinians do not need to prove that they have nothing to do with ISIS, for example, or with all of these jihadist organizations, and they are pushed to actually repeat that all over again. But anyone who actually sees the protest, sees the actions of Palestinians, will immediately, you know, understand that it's completely different stories and can't be compared. When we are talking about also incitement to violence, it's not just you know, carried out by right-wing like Lehava people, and it's people from the Knesset, people from the government itself are inciting against Palestinian officials, against Palestinian politicians, and the violence, the Israeli, the mob violence that we've seen is a direct result of that. It's not, you can't separate the continuous attacks on Palestinian in the street from what politicians are saying, and the fact that anyone, any Palestinian woman, for example, who is identified to be Palestinian, either because she wears veil or because she looks Palestinian, or any man who looks Arab or Palestinian, can be attacked just because of his looks. This proves everything. This proves that this incitement is paying dividends for the Israelis, and this is for Palestinians. They feel, this is why Palestinians feel like it's dangerous for them to actually walk in the streets, because they can be a target of state-sanctioned incitement on a daily basis. What settlers, when settlers burned the Dawabshes, for example, in August, it wasn't an individual act. It was a state-sanctioned terrorist act that is legitimized by states, that it's legitimized by groups that are sponsored and funded directly by the Israeli state. So any attempt to do this delinking, to separate actions of the more extremist settlers from the government and from the political level, is totally not true and doesn't actually reflect the real situation on the ground.
Bador, going back to a little bit to what you said before, many people that I've spoken with around the West Bank and inside 48 present-day Israel in the last few weeks say that what we're seeing on the streets is also a result of the rejection of the Ramallah-based Palestinian Authority on a political level, though the PA's forces are working hand-in-hand, perhaps harder than ever before, to collude with Israeli forces and suppress mass uprisings. Can you talk about the PA's role here, especially over the last 2 months?
It's probably the fact that the PA doesn't have a role in Jerusalem which facilitated this uprising. When Israel closed many of the offices of the PA during the Second Intifada, it thought this would contribute to destroying political life in Jerusalem and make people in Jerusalem only think about making ends meet and going on with their daily lives. What happened is that because the PA doesn't have an effect, an impact, or a direct impact, let's say, whatsoever over Palestinians in Jerusalem, it has not been able to quash the movement. Of course, it has agents, it has its tribal structures in some of the neighborhoods in Jerusalem that it can try to control or assuage the youths, but it doesn't have direct impact on the youth. And this is why the youth uprising in Jerusalem, even though because of the Israeli repression and checkpoint, it hasn't been what it was at the start, but it's still continuing because the PA can't control the youth in Jerusalem. But in places where the PA has control, we have seen that nothing significant has happening, especially in the more urban cities in the West Bank. The PA feels that it is in a very complex and difficult situation. On the one hand, it wants to collude with Israel, because collusion with Israel, when we are talking, the PA cannot sustain itself without security coordination. Security coordination is not just a syndrome. It is part and parcel of the policies. It's part and parcel of the Oslo Accords. And if security coordination with the Israeli occupation falls, the entire PA falls. So on the one hand, the PA can't get rid of that. But on the other hand, the PA doesn't want to completely lose its legitimacy. So it's allowing, in a sense, some protests to continue, especially near the Beit El settlements, where the PA has continuously over the years prevented any confrontations from taking place. Now it can't do that because it will completely galvanize actions against it by the people. So it kind of is allowing it so long as it doesn't, you know, so long as it stays under control. But in places like Hebron, for example, where the PA, due to the special situation of Hebron, where the PA doesn't also have as much control as in other cities, which controls, you see that violent confrontations with Israeli occupations, almost protests on an almost daily basis, you see that this continues. And when we are talking about security coordination, some of the things that we don't see is Israel, the PA arrests, you know, tens, dozens of activists who are active against the Israeli occupation, who the PA accuses of being affiliated to Hamas. And this kind of happens in the dark, because when we are talking about the hundreds of arrests, the more than 1,500 who were arrested on October alone by Israeli occupation forces, we tend to marginalize or forget that there are activists who are also being arrested by the PA as well. And the PA is really trying to do all it can in order to stop this, but in the same time, and coordinate with the Israeli occupation. But at the same time, it's worried because it doesn't want to lose its completely lose its legitimacy in the eyes of the people. So, in a sense, this accusation by the Israeli officials of the PA of being inciting against violence, which is totally not true, kind of serves the PA to portray itself in the eyes of the Palestinians as being a victim, as being persecuted by Israel at a time when you see in villages, in areas, in you see through the raids of hospitals, the PA did nothing to prevent these raids. Some Palestinians would even go as far as to claim that the PA actually helped undercover units of Israeli occupation forces to invade those hospitals and stood by while Palestinian villages and neighborhoods are continuously being attacked and raided by Israeli occupation forces.
Boudour, as a reporter, and of course as someone who lives here in Jerusalem and studies here in Jerusalem, what kinds of stories have impacted you the most in the last few months, and how do you go out and choose what you want to write about? And more than that, what should the role of reporters be in these times of heightened policies of illegal occupation and expulsion?
Perhaps a few people who read my articles for the Electronic Intifada in particular, I try to focus on the personal stories of martyrs, on their lives before they were killed, their families, their dreams, their friends, to actually know the many sides that this guy or this man or this woman had before he or she was killed. And because this demands being in contact with the families and with the friends, the close friends of the martyrs, it always involves a lot of emotional impact on me. I try to, because I live in Jerusalem, so sometimes my main consideration is going to places that are close geographically from Jerusalem, from either in the Jerusalem or Ramallah area. But I also try to make it to Hebron and to Nablus and cover stories there, because I believe that those people are probably more marginalized than Ramallah, because not a lot of media, especially Al-Khalil, Hebron, people feel always there feel that they are marginalized and they are forgotten by the media. And for me, I think it's important to be present everywhere for reporters, not just in the areas that are more famous or more have more reporters or more journalists there. And I think that we haven't seen this enough. Probably the story that affected me the most was the story of Baha Alayan, the scout leader who was killed, who carried out an attack with his friend on a bus in a settlement near Jabal al-Mukabbir, because I knew Baha, I knew his brother, And, you know, when you know someone personally, it always affects you more, even if he wasn't a close friend of yours. And especially hearing the way his father spoke, there was an incident when one of the Girl Scouts who were trained by Baha, his brother Hussam, Baha's brother Hussam, came and told the girl that you need to keep working and you need to continue work even after Baha has died. Life doesn't stop here. And he told her, look, I'm not coming anymore, so you have to keep working. And she told him, what do you mean you're not coming back anymore? These girls have been traumatized. They still are not coming to terms with the fact that their trainer, their mentor, their teacher, the guy who meant so much for them is no longer here. They respect his choice, of course. They totally do, and they respect him, and they are tremendously proud of them. But they feel that no one can make up for his loss. Speaking with the kids, there are many kids who were killed, especially Ahmed Sharake, the 13-year-old child who was killed in Jelzon refugee camp. Speaking with his friends was very emotional. You see how these people are trying to live and continue living after their friends. You feel like, in a sense, you feel that these kids are too young to experience this. They are still children. They deserve to live their childhood. But on the other hand, you see that it's not natural. It's the natural thing for these children to protest, because you see the lives that they are living. You see the constant threats of the Israeli occupation. And you think that the only natural thing, the most logical and rational choice for these kids is to actually resist. You listen to the stories that these kids speak, and you see how all these experiences have made them grow up. You speak with, for example, families whose children's corpses haven't been returned to them. And this was especially painful, listening to all the stories of parents who have been waiting for tens of years, for decades, actually, to bring back the corpses of these children, waiting for a son's corpse to be released, as if they were waiting for a prisoner exchange deal, for a release of an alive prisoner. Some of them are still kind of not believing that their kids have been killed, their children have been killed, because they say, I haven't seen a corpse. I can't believe that my son has been killed unless I see his corpse in my own eyes, unless I see I can bury him or her with my own hands. When the ultimate dream of a mother or a father becomes to actually bury his or her son or daughter with her own hands, you know how much this occupation, this colonial system, has destroyed our lives and has done so many grave violations against our most basic rights, even the right to mourn, the right to be able to carry out a big funeral, the funeral that this guy deserves, the right to bury their children where they want and when they want. When even this very basic right is denied, how can people come and wonder why Palestinians are rising up?
Badour Yusuf Hassan, she's a contributor to the Electronic Intifada. You're also a writer and a graduate of law school, and you live here in Jerusalem. Badour, thank you so much for all of your work and for being with us again on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you.
And that's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net, where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and if you're listening on iTunes, support the Electronic Intifada podcast by rating it and leaving a review. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis
of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, who explains why she believes that in the aftermath of the terrorist attacks in Paris, reliance on military strategies alone cannot defeat ISIS. Nate Cardozo of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who criticizes officials calling for expanded surveillance after the Paris attacks, as cynical politics at their absolute worst. And excerpts of speeches by Desmond Batts and Bernardo McLaughlin addressing climate change issues at the recent 100% Renewable Energy for 100% of the People rally in Hartford, Connecticut. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A few days after the terror attacks in Paris, suicide bombers in northeast Nigeria detonated two explosions that killed 49 people and injured over 100 civilians. The attacks were blamed on Boko Haram, the long-running Islamist insurgency responsible for killing over 17,000 people and forcing over 2.5 million people to flee their homes in Africa's Lake Chad region. The attacks came after the Nigerian army had pressed an offensive into Boko Haram-held territory. Boko Haram has been named by the Institute of Economics and Peace as the most violent terrorist group in the world, narrowly surpassing ISIL after the carnage it inflicted in Syria and Iraq during 2014. Boko Haram won international condemnation when it kidnapped 276 schoolgirls from the village of Chibok. 50 girls later escaped their captors, but the fate of the remaining students remains a mystery. Many local Muslim imams and Christian priests have stepped forward to feed the hundreds of thousands of people displaced by the terrorist group in Nigeria. Public images of poverty in America are mostly portrayed in urban scenes of black and Hispanic destitution, often linked to drugs and gangs. But the flip side of poverty found in rural America is often associated with small towns inhabited by whites in Appalachia, the Ozarks, and the Dakotas. According to the news magazine In These Times, since the 1950s, poverty in rural America has increased. This is especially true in the American South, where rural poverty has grown 8% faster than that found in cities. While the white population makes up the majority of urban and rural poor, rates of deprivation run much deeper in minority rural populations. Poverty rates among blacks, Latinos, and Native Americans are much higher than for whites living in rural America. Ozarks native Lisa Pruitt, now a law professor at the University of California at Davis, commented, "When we talk about poverty, we focus on black poverty and we focus on Hispanic poverty. We've collapsed our nation's poverty problem into our nation's racism problem, and it leads us to turn a blind eye to rural poverty." For thousands of years, the Western Shoshone tribal community has gathered at the Tosawihi quarries in Elk County, Nevada, to collect flint stones and to practice spiritual rituals. The word Tosawihi means white knives, an ancient ancestral name that ties the Shoshone to the land and to its cultural identity. For generations, gold deposits were found underneath the flint, and wealthy miners are now eager to extract it, reports the news magazine In These Times. 2 years ago, the Waterton Global Mining Company bought an abandoned gold mine and quickly launched operations with the blessing of the U.S. Bureau of Land Management. However, tribal leader Joe Holly of the Battle Mountain Band of the Western Shoshone says new drilling pads were constructed on pristine land, but the mining company didn't obtain the necessary groundwater permits. A lawyer for the Battle Mountain Band filed an emergency appeal with the Interior Board of Appeals. The tribe is seeking to suspend mining until a plan is approved to safeguard the cultural integrity of the quarries. But the mining company, now named Carlin Resources, challenged the appeal, saying the case was filled with erroneous and sensationalistic assertions. The Bureau of Land Management, which oversees this stretch of federal land, identified numerous cultural artifacts, including ancient stone tools, that were discovered on the site, and instructed miners to stay out of the area where the antiquities were found. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
Thank you.
After the multiple terrorist attacks in Paris on November 13th that killed 130 and wounded 350 more, French President François Hollande declared war on ISIS, the group which claimed responsibility for the massacre of Parisians at a stadium, concert hall, restaurants, and cafes. Before a joint session of Parliament, Hollande said the coordinated terrorist assault was an attack against our country, against its values, against its youth, against its way of life. Amid fear of new attacks, France and Belgium launched dozens of raids on the homes of suspected terrorists and their accomplices. In retaliation for the carnage in Paris, President Hollande ordered the French Air Force to increase airstrikes against ISIS targets in the group's self-declared capital in Raqqa, Syria, bombing command and recruitment centers, as well as an ammunition storage base and training camps. The French president, vowing to destroy ISIS, called on Russia and America to unite our forces in a coalition to defeat the terrorist group, a goal made more difficult by Turkey's recent shooting down of a Russian fighter jet engaged in combat near the Syrian-Turkish border. In a recent article published in The Nation magazine titled, "After the Paris Attacks, A Call for Justice, Not Vengeance," Phyllis Bennis recounts how 14 years of war after the 9/11 attacks against the U.S. have failed to defeat terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. Your reporter spoke with Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, about her view that reliance on military strategies alone cannot defeat ISIS, and the domestic backlash against Syrian war refugees.
What I'm really afraid was the response in Paris, Scott, was that there was a tendency from President Hollande and other French officials to seem to be channeling George Bush, both at the moment of those horrific attacks when this horrible crime was greeted in Paris with the words, "This is war, and we will answer it with war." That was exactly the words of George Bush. It was George Bush who told us that there is only one choice, that the choice is either go to war or let them get away with it. And since nobody obviously wanted to, quote, let them get away with it, an awful lot of people chose war. The problem, of course, putting aside any sense of morality and even international law issues, just if we look at the question of the efficacy, what we see is that we've been using war for 14 years as a way of challenging terrorism. And it hasn't worked. It absolutely has not worked. If it had worked, we wouldn't have seen this escalation of terrorist attacks that we're seeing right this minute. There's this sense that there's no option. The only debate that we're hearing about in Washington right now, in official circles and the official media, is whether or not there should be U.S. ground troops. Nobody is challenging the fundamental question of, does war work against terrorism? Because the bottom line is, terrorism survives war. Terrorism thrives in war. ISIS wants U.S. troops on the ground. The notion that the only debate is, do we send U.S. troops on the ground or do we send Saudi troops on the ground? You know, that's just off. No one is challenging the airstrikes. No one is challenging the assassination program that's known as the drone strikes. You know, no one is acknowledging that this has been going on for years and it has not worked. Terrorism has thrived throughout. So what's needed is a very different understanding of what the options are. Starting, I would assert, with what every medical student is taught in their first day of medical school, the Hippocratic Oath, first, do no harm. Whatever else you do to your patient, don't make it worse. And of course, what the U.S. is doing is making everything worse.
Phyllis, ISIS has often been described as a death cult, using mass slaughter as a strategy and a tactic to rebuild what they say is a long-gone glorious Islamic caliphate that they're now trying to rebuild. There are many who view ISIS as an existential threat to Western civilization if it isn't destroyed. And the military option, as many see it, is the only way to destroy ISIS, to achieve that goal. What's your response to that?
You know, if your position is the only choice is war or nothing, war seems better than nothing. War seems better than letting them get away with it. But it's not enough to say, these guys are so violent that of course we have to use military force against them. The answer is, these guys are so violent, we need to figure out much more strategically, how do we cut off their funding? Well, where's their funding coming from? It's coming a lot from Saudi Arabia. What kind of pressure can we put on the Saudis? Well, we're selling them billions of dollars worth of weapons. Let's put a price on that and say, not one more weapon, not one more smart bomb, not one more anything, until you cut all access of Saudi money, whether it's coming from the government, from the king, from some prince, from some wealthy individual. That's one possibility. We could cut off the ability of ISIS to sell the oil that they have taken. That's about half their income. Right now, the oil companies are buying and selling Syrian oil, ISIS oil, as if it was normal. There's no campaign against it, equivalent to the Blood Diamonds campaign, for instance, of a few years ago. All of these possibilities are crucial, but none of them are really possible as long as we are focused on this kind of war response.
Well, Phyllis, just a final question for you here, and that is, after the Paris attacks, we've seen some very ugly responses in the United States, particularly reactions from Republican candidates for president, to not only reject Syrian refugees, both by these candidates, but also more than 25 U.S. governors to basically block the entry of Syrian refugees into their states. But we've also had specific proposals from presidential candidate Donald Trump to close mosques, register all Muslims in the country, issue religious-based ID cards to these Muslims. What are your concerns about this? Is this something that's a temporary loss of sanity, or is this some longer-term problem that we all have to address as Americans?
I think it's both. What we have to face, we don't have a refugee crisis. We have a racism crisis underway, and we need to take that very, very seriously.
That was Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Her newest book is titled Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror, A Primer. For more analysis and commentary on the response to the ISIS attacks in Paris, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After the tragic terrorist attacks that killed scores of Parisians across the City of Light, there have been calls by some U.S. politicians, government officials, and conservative pundits to reverse reforms that have recently been enacted to rein in America's mass surveillance programs initiated under the post-9/11 USA Patriot Act. CIA Director John Brennan, FBI Director James Comey, and New York City Police Commissioner Bill Bratton have been critical of the reforms initiated after former NSA contractor-turned-whistleblower Edward Snowden revealed to the world the extent of warrantless surveillance targeting millions of Americans. Republican Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas has introduced legislation that would delay implementation of restrictions on bulk collection of phone metadata that were included in the USA Freedom Act that was passed with overwhelming bipartisan support last June. Under that legislation, the government's authority to collect telephone metadata will end this year on November 29th. Another area of controversy that's come into focus after the Paris attacks is the easy access consumers now have to encryption programs from companies including Apple and Google. Law enforcement officials want these companies to build a backdoor to their programs that would allow intelligence agencies to decode encrypted messages. But critics contend that such a backdoor would make those devices and software more vulnerable to hacking by criminals and spies. Your reporter spoke with Nate Cardozo, staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who criticizes officials now calling for expanded surveillance in the aftermath of the Paris attacks as cynical politics at their absolute worst.
The calls that we've seen from CIA Director Brennan, from NYPD Commissioner Bratton, and even from the likes of Hillary Clinton and John McCain in the wake of the Paris attacks are, you know, cynical politics at their absolute worst. The Paris attacks were planned using Facebook and unsecured SMS messaging, using unsecured phones. They literally had nothing to do with encryption. At least one, and we think more, of the attackers were known to European intelligence services. So to see CIA Director Brennan come out in the wake of the Paris attacks and claim that this is proof that Snowden had something, is to blame for this, or that encryption is somehow to blame, is cynical and frankly disgusting, a use of opportunism here.
I wondered if we'd talk a little bit about the USA Freedom Act. As I understand it, restrictions under the USA Freedom Act, passed by Congress and signed into law by President Obama last spring, will end government collection of bulk phone metadata on November 29th. In response to the Paris attacks, Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas has put forward a bill that would delay implementation of the USA Freedom Act. And he's titled this legislation the Liberty Through Strength Act. Respond to Tom Cotton and his allies that are trying to delay implementation of the USA Freedom Act, which was passed by Congress in a bipartisan way overwhelmingly.
And was supported by the Director of National Intelligence. The NSA has said that they don't need the bulk telephone metadata collection program anymore. In the entire operation of the program from late 2001 to today, according to the NSA's own testimony to both the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, that program stopped a single terror activity within the United States. And it wasn't an attack. It was a San Diego cab driver transferring $8,500 to al-Shabaab in Somalia. So all of our constitutional rights have been invaded since late 2001, early 2002. And for what gain? We stopped $8,500 making it to al-Shabaab. Luckily, Mr. Cotton, Representative Cotton's proposal to push back the implementation of USA Freedom until after the next election. Our intelligence on the Hill says that that's not going anywhere. The NSA itself has no interest in delaying the implementation of USA Freedom. They're ready to roll out at the end of this month, and it's our firm belief that that is going to happen. But just to talk about USA Freedom, the restrictions that are placed on the NSA by USA Freedom are quite minimal. But at the same time, they are the first restrictions on NSA power that Congress has passed since I've been alive, since 1978, when the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act was passed. So yeah, USA Freedom doesn't do that much, but it does something to restrict the NSA's unconstitutional powers. And getting something done to rein in the NSA, what was in and of itself an achievement.
Well, Nate, I wanted to get to something you touched on earlier, and that is there a problem with the lack of authority to obtain necessary surveillance information, or is the problem the inability to sort through the mountains, the literal mountains of information that's already been collected in order to predict and stop future terrorist attacks?
Well, former NSA Director Michael Hayden, I think, put it very well. From an intelligence agency perspective, they don't really care much about what people are saying. They care about when they're saying it, where they're saying it, and who they're saying it to. And encryption doesn't mask any of those things. It only masks the what. It doesn't mask the who, it doesn't mask the where, and it doesn't mask the when. And what Hayden said, which I find troubling for a different reason, but for these purposes, I think it's illuminating, is we kill people based on metadata. The drone strikes that the U.S. government operates in Yemen, in Pakistan, in Sudan, are in large part, possibly in the majority, although only the CIA knows this, but are at least in large part based solely on the metadata that's being collected overseas. The actual content of the communications are almost irrelevant. So from the CIA's perspective and from the NSA's perspective, metadata is plenty, and that's all still available.
That was Nate Cardozo, staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. For more perspectives on the post-Paris attack debate on the expansion or reform of U.S. surveillance programs, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A coalition of activist groups rallied at the Capitol building in Hartford, Connecticut on November 21st calling for 100% renewable energy for 100% of the people. Organizers, including the Connecticut chapter of the Sierra Club, 350CT.org, and more than two dozen faith-based, local governmental, anti-nuclear, and other groups, oppose Connecticut Governor Daniel Malloy's plan to vastly increase the use of fracked natural gas in the state, which he claims is a bridge to a clean energy future. While natural gas burns more cleanly than other fossil fuels, studies show that leaks of methane, the main component of gas, from pipes and other infrastructure, can make it more damaging to the climate than coal. Speakers at the rally addressed the health impacts of fossil fuels and called for the closure of the state's last remaining coal plant in Bridgeport. They also addressed the disproportionate negative effects on people of color, as well as labor concerns. Connecticut currently depends on nuclear power from the Millstone Reactor Complex in Waterford for almost half its electricity. Critics say the goal of transitioning to 100% renewable energy, powered by the sun, wind, and small hydroelectric, without natural gas, cannot be accomplished by 2030 or even 2050, as some advocates claim. But climate activists say, with political will, it is possible, citing examples of several U.S. cities and nations, such as Germany, that have made significant strides toward transitioning to renewable energy. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was at the rally and recorded the speakers. We hear first from Desmond Batts, a member of the Sierra Club of Connecticut's Executive Committee, followed by Bernardo McLaughlin of the group Capitalism versus the Climate.
Environmental justice means that no community should be overburdened with environmental burdens and not receive the environmental benefits. But those of us who live in environmental communities, we see firsthand that we are on the front lines. We are the canaries in the coal mines, and we are disproportionately affected by climate change. When people in Hartford look out their front doors, they don't see beautiful scenery and parks. They don't see happy families playing. They don't see self-actualized, self-aware people planning their future. But I tell you what they do see. They see garbage. They see abandoned buildings. They see cold, hard streets, colder politics, and colder policies. They don't see open spaces. They see cracks in sidewalks where green grass fights in vain to be noticed. They see empty dope bags. They see crack vials instead of smiles and dreams being fulfilled. They see violence, unemployment, suffering, and chaos. So why would they step out of their homes to take a walk or to play a game when that walk or that game could very well end in harm for them? You know, it's a big misconception about the black community that we don't care about the environment. We don't care about climate change. And that couldn't be further from the truth. The truth is that we do care about climate change, but we care about feeding our kids. We care about having a place to live. We care about clothes on our backs before that. And maybe a few more concerns, and then comes climate change. But I tell you what, when we look at the communities of color, climate change is a very small fish. But when the effects of climate change come back around, that big fish becomes a ravenous beast. It is a shark that will devour not only our neighborhoods, but yours as well. I tell you right now, today is not a time for talk. Today is a time for change. It is a time for action. I'll leave you with one of my favorite quotes by Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. He says, "A threat to justice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere." Let's stay in the fight.
My name is Bernardo McLaughlin. I'm a member of a group here in Connecticut called Capitalism versus the Climate. On Monday, I locked myself to a piece of equipment in eastern Connecticut at a work site of Spectra Energy, which is expanding their gas pipeline in order to transfer more fracking extracted gas through our backyards. I did it because I'm as inspired by the strategy that led to the victory against the Keystone XL pipeline, one of the first major victories we've had recently against climate chaos. And that strategy has to be adopted and repeated. Earlier this year, Connecticut had one of its first significant real days of direct action in recent memory here in my city, Hartford, where those of us who were part of the Hartford 17 shut down one of the main traffic arteries that's used by corporate commuters to flee our city before the sun goes down. And we did it to send a message that if the wealthy and the powerful don't think that Black Lives Matter, then we'll assert that business as usual doesn't matter. And what we accomplished that day
that the elite of Hartford were put on notice that our neighbors will not be brutalized without consequences. And we show that Connecticut is not immune to the radical, powerful spirit that's sweeping the globe today. We can take direct action and make our power felt if we so choose. And I'll take it a step further and argue that we don't have a choice, that the political establishment has already made that choice for us when it demonstrated to us that flooded neighborhoods in New York and New Orleans were acceptable losses as long as their penthouses stayed above water. That choice was made for us as Obama signed off on the southern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline and as he presided over a large-scale federal campaign of undermining climate justice through the state repression of our fellow activists across the country. It is clear that where the line has been drawn, and we have not been the ones to draw it. I really hate going to jail, and I hate being on the receiving end of the police state that black and brown communities endure every day on a much greater scale. But most of all, I hate feeling powerless while the world goes to hell. And what I learned on Monday was that you have as much power as you're willing to exercise. When we're told to work inside the system, to cultivate good relationships with politicians who are bought and sold by the fossil fuels industry to be respectable and law-abiding, we're being convinced that we're powerless. And what I can tell you for sure, not only as a student of history, but also as a labor movement activist and a steward with my union, is that when we're organized and brought to the point we've been pushed to, people like us are the most powerful force on the planet. I also want you to consider what it means for us to take care of each other while we're fighting. This next week, we're going to be dealing with the consequences of another climate catastrophe that has in part to do with the Syrian civil war and its consequences there. And we're going to be back here at the Capitol at 10 a.m. next week to demonstrate our solidarity against xenophobia and hatred against Syrian refugees. Thank you.
That was Bernardo McLaughlin of the group Capitalism Versus the Climate, preceded by Desmond Batts, a member of the Sierra Club of Connecticut's Executive Committee, speaking at the 100% Renewable Energy for 100% of the People rally in Hartford, Connecticut, on November 21st. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. Find more information on the group's organizing against expansion of fracked natural gas infrastructure in Connecticut and across New England by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Reese, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jabal's radio essay.
And now, Laquan. With a name like Laquan, we can safely assume his blackness, of middling height, perhaps 5'2", with a weight of 130 pounds or so. Laquan bounces down a Chicago avenue with typical teenage abandon. He seems more like he's skipping than running, his right hand holding a penknife of some 3 inches or so. One can almost feel the buzz of youthful testosterone rushing through his veins, a subterranean river of strength, assuring him that he is invincible, that he can punch through walls, get hit with a mountain, and rise. And then, without warning, a shot rings out, and it spins him like a top, 360 degrees. He falls. An unfamiliar pain grips him, curling him, folding him into a fetal position, cradled by the cold earth. Then, like heartbeats, come death beats of bullets, and 17-year-old Laquan McDonald is no more. He is but the latest black body blasted into oblivion by a white Klansman in blue. His once unknown name joins a chorus of the dead: Tamir Rice, Mike Brown, Donald Dante Ivy, Eric Garner, Oscar Grant, Freddie Gray, and more, victims all of one of the oldest maladies on the American mainland, white fear. A 3-inch blade, legal, by the way, and 16 shots burned into the body of a teenager. For a year, the cameras go dark until a freelance journalist fights and wins a freedom of information suit against the city of Chicago. The camera replays that savage moment of a boy skipping his way into death. There has been an arrest, yes, but don't be surprised if there is also an acquittal. Any city that can make a murder disappear for a year can surely hustle up an acquittal. Only sustained struggle can make a difference. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
What provoked the Turkish Air Force to shoot down a Russian jet? How will this incident play into the building conflict around Syria? Is it possible to make a distinction between the Islamic State militants and a more moderate resistance to the Syrian regime? Where does Kurdistan fit into the broader scheme of things? Is a full-scale military confrontation over Syria imminent? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we take a closer look at the dynamics playing themselves out in Syria in the wake of the Paris attacks and the recently downed Russian Su-24 jet. Our guests are Toronto-based international criminal lawyer Christopher Black and University of Sydney-based professor and author Tim Anderson. On this week's program, Turkish Follies, NATO-Russia Standoff, and the Fate of Syria. Bringing you the analysis beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of November 27th, 2015. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Strategic alliances are often characterized by cross-cutting coalitions between opposing sides, which in some cases lead to destabilizing the broader structure of military alliances. Unquestionably, Washington's intent is to establish a cross-cutting relationship with the People's Republic of China with a view to eventually undermining and destabilizing China's alliance with Russia. U.S. foreign policy in relation to China could be described as a threaten-cooperate strategy. It consists in threatening China with a view to forcing China to cooperate with the U.S. Is Washington attempting to rebuild its strategic relations with China with a view to eventually weakening and isolating Russia? That comes from the article, Russia-China Relations and the Downing of Russia's Jet Fighter by Turkey, by Professor Michel Chalcedovsky, posted November 25th. Information has come from Syrian sources that last night, November 24th, the Russian Aerospace Defense Forces struck with massive attacks on the positions of militants, including Turkmens, in the region where the Russian Su-24 was brought down. Meanwhile, there's appeared information that the Turks are not putting their fighters in the air after the majority of them were lit up by Russian radar, the S-300, and according to early reports, possibly the S-400. After the statement of the Ministry of Defense of Russia, Turkey is afraid that their planes can be destroyed when approaching the border. Erdogan has acknowledged that if the Russian plane even violated the border of Turkey, this was for 17 seconds, which means that the Turkish Air Force, on purely physical grounds, could not have reacted to it if the provocation was not prepared in advance. This figure of 17 seconds appears in NATO reports. That comes from the article, Russian Air Force Annihilated Militants in Area Where Su-24 Was Shot Down. Erdogan Ordered Turkish Air Force Planes Be Grounded. Posted November 25th, originally appearing at cont.ws, translated by Carpatho Russian, exclusively for South Front. We know that Turkey is lying for three reasons. One reason is that NATO governments lie every time that they open their mouths. A second reason is that Turkey's claim that the Su-24 was in Turkey's airspace for 17 seconds but only traveled 1.15 miles means that the Su-24 was flying at stall speed. A third reason is that assuming Turkey's claim of a 17-second airspace violation is true, 17 seconds is not long enough for a Turkish pilot to get clearance for such a serious and reckless act as shooting down a Russian military aircraft. If the Su-24 was flying at a normal speed rather than one that would be unable to keep the aircraft aloft, the alleged airspace violation would not have been long enough to be noticed. That comes from the article, The Downed Russian Su-24, Turkey is Lying, NATO Governments Lie Every Time They Open Their Mouths, by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted November 25th, originally appearing at paulcraigroberts.org. Russia denies that the Russian fighter jet, which was bombing ISIS, ever entered Turkish airspace and has put out its own map purporting to prove that claim. The Russian jet pilots who parachuted free of their burning plane were then purportedly killed by Turkish rebels inside Syria. Then, when a Russian helicopter tried to save the pilots, it was shot down by American-backed Syrian rebels using weapons provided to them by the United States, and a Russian Marine was killed. Russia is deploying a warship off the Syrian coast to, quote, destroy any threats to Russian planes, unquote. Many believe that this is the start of World War III. That comes from the article, Turkish Shootdown of Russian Jet, What You Need to Know, by Washington's blog posted November 25th. It can safely be assumed that the U.S. influenced Turkey into shooting down the Russian jet over Syrian airspace, predicting quite accurately that this would immediately lead to the deterioration of ties between the two states. An elementary forecast of the specific countermeasures that Russia may take stipulates that these will likely relate to the diplomatic, economic, and energy sectors, which is just what the U.S. wants. The reaction that no one could have predicted, however, is the U.S. purposely leaking comments to Reuters that support the Russian version of events, namely that the anti-terrorist jet was shot down while flying over Syrian airspace. This completely conflicts with what the U.S. and NATO have said in public, but it shows that the U.S. has had enough time to game out the plane shooting scenario well in advance, and that it's playing a sinister divide-and-conquer game against Turkey and Russia. Put in the position where its decision-makers are scrambling for responses to the unprecedented aggression against them, Russia can now more easily be led into supporting the Kurdish struggle for sovereignty, whether formally independent or de facto so, in Turkey, which coincides with one of the U.S. premier geopolitical projects. That comes from the article, Why is the U.S. Hanging Turkey Out to Dry? By Andrew Korybko, posted November 25th, originally appearing at Oriental Review. In December 2014, the Jerusalem Post in Israel reported the findings of a largely ignored and politically explosive report detailing UN sightings of Israeli military together with ISIS terrorist combatants. the UN documents showed that the Israeli Defense Forces, IDF, were maintaining regular contact with members of the so-called Islamic State since May of 2013. The IDF stated that this was only for medical care for civilians, but the deception was broken when the UNDOF observers identified direct contact between IDF forces and ISIS soldiers, including giving medical care to ISIS fighters. Observations even included the transfer of two crates from the IDF to ISIS forces, the contents of which have not been confirmed. Further, the UN report identified what the Syrians label a quote-unquote crossing point of forces between Israel and ISIS, a point of concern UNDOF brought before the UN Security Council. That comes from the article, Guess Who is Behind the Islamic State? Israeli Colonel Caught with IS Pants Down, by F. William Engdahl, posted November 26th, originally appearing at New Eastern Outlook. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. The Turkish Air Force fired on and shot down a Russian warplane on Tuesday, November 24th, claiming to have warned the craft repeatedly against crossing into the country's airspace from Syria. One of the two pilots has been rescued by the Syrian army and has countered these claims, saying that he was not warned and that he had not veered into the airspace of the NATO member country. Turkey's claims of a violation of its airspace are being responded to by Russia, saying it was a planned provocation, and the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, has accused the downing of the Russian jet as, quote, a stab in the back by the accomplices of terrorism. So what does this action mean in the wider context of the NATO-Russian standoff? Joining me to discuss this is Christopher Black. He's an international criminal lawyer based in Toronto and a member of the Law Society of Upper Canada. And he's written a number of articles for New Eastern Outlook and is published on the Global Research website. Mr. Black, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Okay, so first of all, could you help us understand what possible motives could Turkey have had for firing on this Russian craft?
Well, it seems clear to any observer, an independent observer, that this is an attempt, A, to provoke Russia and interfere with its campaign against the ISIS groups attacking the Syrian government, and also to establish a no-fly zone, in effect, over northern Syria to protect the supply routes to those ISIS terrorist groups inside Syria. It's quite clear that from what they've said, that they don't want any Russian planes coming anywhere near that border, which means they really are trying to enforce a no-fly zone in a sovereign country. I don't think Russia is going to let that happen. It's probably going to be the reverse now. But it's also, I think, a deliberate provocation against Russia to see what they will do. Either they have to react militarily, or it looks like they're going to react with economic sanctions first. Or stop their operations or risk further. And Erdogan said today, I saw on RT, that they're going to shoot down more if they, quote-unquote, cross their lines. So it doesn't look good. But that's the motivation. Why, as I said out of my article, the United States and its allies want to eliminate the Syrian government because it stands in the way of their ultimate objective of setting up a puppet state inside that region, and in order to finally arrange land forces to attack Iran, because they can't do it by sea from the Persian Gulf. I think Iran's the ultimate objective, and after that, Russia. And Russia was attacked, has been under attack really since 1999 when the NATO aggression against Yugoslavia took place.
Hmm.
Now, you rule out the possibility that Turkey was acting independently.
I think that's absolutely impossible. There's no way that they shot down that plane when they're now saying that it was only in the airspace for 17 seconds. And in a letter posted on news sites today, the Turkish embassy wrote to NATO stating that the plane had been warned 10 times over 5 minutes, and yet it was only in their airspace for 17 seconds. So why were they warning it if they did for 5 minutes? What they're saying is that you're crossing over into Syrian airspace. We don't want you in. So that's the real reason. And that plane would not have fired that missile without orders from its headquarters. And we know that the Americans are very deeply involved in Turkish military affairs. And they're there. And they sent six F-16s just recently to Turkey to beef up. And for what reason? In fact, we don't even know whether this F-16 was one of theirs or one of the Americans, but I won't go that far. But it's quite clear that this could not have happened without approval from Washington. And the reaction from the NATO countries, from Obama to Cameron, indicates that they're not surprised this happened. They knew it was going to happen, and they approve of it.
Yeah. So if that's the case, and NATO is, I think you the way you put it in your article is they're testing Russia's resolve in Syria. Well, what does that mean?
Well, they've made, ever since the Russians began this campaign to eliminate the forces attacking the Syrian government, they've been making complaints that it's really they're attacking the good guy, the good rebels, so-called, and they're killing civilians, none of which is true. And it's really quite clearly an attempt for them to stop the Russian bombing campaign or impede it in some way, to give their forces that they support financially and militarily some breathing space to try and reorganize. I don't think they're going to succeed in that, but that's what they're trying to do. And it may escalate from there. That's what the danger is. It's going to escalate from there because Russia is not going to stop that campaign. In fact, there's news on Global Research that they took retaliatory action against the men that murdered that pilot who was hanging in his parachute.
Well, yeah, I mean, would you describe this shooting down of a Russian jet as an act of desperation because the campaign to funnel support for those terrorists is so threatened? I mean, would you call it an act of desperation?
I'm not sure I'd call it an act of desperation. Yeah, in a way, it's an attempt to disrupt that campaign. I'm not sure it's an act of desperation as much as a calculated action thought out well ahead of time. They knew when the Russian campaign started a few weeks ago, no doubt these things have been, something's been planned. There's been some reaction planned. And as you know, I still think myself that the events in the shooting down of the Russian airline over Sinai and the events in Paris are linked to this, and the entire sudden appearance of all these refugees pouring across the European borders raises hysteria in Europe and justifies, or they seem to justify, or they're used to justify the calls by NATO governments for a big invasion or a big attack on ISIS, which really is a cover for attacking Syria. Mm-hmm. And that's, to me, the whole objective is to just get the people in the NATO countries' domestic population to support such an attack.
Could I just get you to briefly explain this whole concept, because the official line is that they're supporting the moderate rebels, and could you maybe just take a brief time just to dismiss that contention?
Yeah, the Americans especially and their allies keep claiming that there are moderate rebels, that is good rebels, attacking the Syrian people, and yet as we know, the Russians, Mr. Lavrov and Putin have said, tell us who they are, we won't go near them. They refuse to tell them. They give them no names. They say, okay, tell us who not to bomb. Okay, tell us who to bomb then. And they've never answered. And in fact, just a week or two before the bomb, the Russian campaign began, the American government, and I think Obama even said, that there are no moderate rebels still existing. They've all either collapsed or they've all, if they ever existed, they've melted into the other Al-Qaeda and ISIS groups. So the Russians have called the Americans bluff by saying, well, you know, if you say they're good guys, we'd like to talk to them. Give us their names. Where are they? Who are they? No response. So it's just a fiction. There are no good rebels in Syria. They're all proxy forces, as they were in Libya, to bring down the Syrian government on behalf of the United States and its allies.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up Libya, because I thought it sounds like there's a parallel situation growing here. I mean, are there any important differences between what the regime change that happened in Libya under the cover of a humanitarian intervention and the regime change that may be looming in Syria?
Yeah, the big difference is that this time the Russians and the Chinese are not approving any no-fly zone over Syria. They made a mistake in 2011. I was in Moscow at that time, and it was a very depressed mood. I met with the deputy foreign minister at that point, and the mood was very depressed because they felt betrayed. They had thought that by approving a no-fly zone, that's all it was going to be, but the NATO used that as a device to launch a huge military attack on Libya and destroyed a very progressive country, reduced it to chaos. And then the rebels there were also mainly brought in, mercenaries brought in, proxies and thugs and all sorts of riffraff brought in from outside Afghanistan and elsewhere to cause trouble and justify this bombing campaign. And even the International Criminal Court stepped in and helped by labeling Gaddafi a war criminal. So you can't negotiate with war criminals. And they did that with Milosevic in the NATO campaign against Yugoslavia. You can't negotiate with war criminals. And it almost justifies these attacks in the eyes of people in say, in Canada, United States. So there is a big difference this time that Russia does not allow the United States and its NATO allies to do what they want this time. Now they're resisting. And I think that's a fundamental difference and one they can't overcome.
It seems to me the last time the U.S.-NATO alliance tried to attempt a military intervention in Syria, it was niftily deflected by Russian diplomacy. And I'm wondering if we've gotten to the point now where no such maneuver is possible.
I think we're at that point. I agree with you. In 2013, they tried to use a fake chemical attack to justify an attack. The Russians used one of Kerry's comments to hoist him on his own petard and stop that attack from taking place. But it's too late now, and there's no such thing that can be used now, not with this escalation. And it's quite clear that they're willing to risk killing anybody in order to achieve their aim. They don't care whether it's a Russian tourist on a civilian airliner or people in Paris or whoever. They don't care. And they're willing to push it to the limit. And that's quite clear. And we saw that in Crimea. I mean, they support the fascist regime, as far as I'm concerned, a fascist regime in Kiev, bombing its own people. And now they've sabotaged the electricity grid in Crimea, putting 2 million people without power. And you can expect more sabotage there. So there's an attack on Russia on two fronts, at least. Mm. And they're not going to stop. There's going to be a military confrontation one way or another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
which is a dangerous thing.
You mentioned this is a part of a long-term agenda going back to the bombing of Yugoslavia way back in the 1990s.
Right.
So if we're on that trajectory, and maybe the Russians have been able to slow it down, but they've not been able to stop it. What happens after? Are we going to see a war in Syria? Are we going to see a superpowers confrontation over Syria?
Well, that's the danger. The reason that they were allowed to get away with attacking Yugoslavia is because during that period, 1999, the Russian government was still under the sway of the Yeltsin regime, or the tail end of the Yeltsin regime. And under the Yeltsin regime, I mean, Yeltsin, Russians told me that they know he's basically an American agent. That Russia was totally under their sway under his regime. They could do anything they wanted, and Russia was fine for them because they did what they were told. But with the United Russia Party and Putin coming in, and nationalists of various types, and the rise of even the Communist Party is coming back in Russia, but the rise of nationalism generally, or patriotism, if you want to call it that way, refer to it that way, that's not possible anymore. They're totally different people. The people that were playing with the West are being discredited and pushed aside. And if Yugoslavia had happened now, I'm sure Yugoslavia would still exist, and there would have been a resistance. Russia would never have allowed that to happen. But under Yeltsin, the bombs fell on Belgrade continuously without any Russian resistance. But now, the stakes are very high for the United States. As I said in my article, they have this agenda, and I think there's certain factions in the United States, it seems, who are willing to risk world war in order to achieve it. I hope they don't win out, but we saw it happen in World War II. People can push and start things they may not intend.
Do you have any kind of a grasp of what Russia's options are at this moment, diplomatic, political, economic?
Well, I saw in the news today they've already started economic pressure. They've already stopped certain food imports into Turkey immediately under the claim that they don't meet quality standards. Hmm. That's obviously a cover. But they promised, Medvedev today promised very harsh economic reaction, canceling investment projects, canceling tourism, telling Russians not to go there, and also blocking trade with Turkey. But I think there will be a military response in some way. They've already had that against the people that shot the pilot. And I would suspect that if any Turkish airplane gets near the border of Syria, it's going to come down. Mm-hmm. And I would be surprised if they allow anybody, any foreign air force, to fly over Syria now, including French, British, or American jets, because they can't be trusted. And why should they? It doesn't make logical sense. Syria is a sovereign country. Only jets from forces it's invited in should be there. Anybody else is invading it. So I think we'll see something like that happen. They'll establish a no-fly zone, and they will enforce it. They've already said that. They posted the missile cruiser in Moskva off the coast and said they will shoot down anything that threatens their forces, and they will.
So
and Russians are very angry.
Mm-hmm. Do you find, I mean, I know that there's another powerful player in this whole drama, and that's China. Do you see any way in which China could somehow influence the situation?
Yes, China is currently a Russian ally, of course, in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, although it's actually holding some military drills in cooperation with the United States Navy last few weeks. But the tensions in the South China Sea with the Americans pushing them there still forces the Chinese to ally themselves with Russia. And they've indicated they support Russian policy in Syria. Whether they'll send forces there, I doubt that, but it's possible, but I doubt that. And the ships have been in the Mediterranean from time to time. It's possible they could send some in a show of support, but the Chinese are very very careful about what they do, so I don't know. I can't predict what they will do, but I'm sure they'll support whatever Russia decides to do.
So then I guess the question remains, what couldn't the general public in NATO-aligned countries do to potentially deflect this march to world war?
Well, the sad thing is that the anti-war movement in North America and Europe is almost defunct. I know people in the anti-war movement here, peace groups, but they can't get any traction, despite no matter how hard they try. The press doesn't cover it. People are depressed. People are frustrated. There have been anti-NATO demonstrations in Italy and Germany. A couple of weeks ago, I did a story on that. There was an anti-NATO movement begun, and there were rallies in Milan and Naples and Rome, and I think some in Germany, but it hasn't really gained any traction. But it was a good sign that something may be developing. But the sad fact is the anti-war movement since 2003, when the
the big demonstrations took place around the world against the invasion of the attack on Iraq are almost evaporated. And it's time for people to get back on the streets to demonstrate and stop our governments from engaging in the, encouraging these wars. In fact, in Canada, for instance, as an aside, all deployments of Canadian forces overseas are illegal under the National Defense Act because it says you can't deploy our forces overseas except in compliance with a UN mandate or if there's an actual attack on a NATO country by another country, not by some terrorist groups. Neither one of those conditions holds, and yet we've been sending forces into everywhere for the last 20 years. Nobody says anything about it. The mass media doesn't cover it. Nobody in Parliament says anything about it. But that could be a device used by the peace movement to hang something on and say, why are you engaging in something which is forbidden by Canadian law? It's just one device, but the question is how to generate people's enthusiasm and a sense that they can actually go out in the streets and get something accomplished. And we also have the memory of the G20 demonstration where a peaceful demonstration was attacked by the police. People remember that, and that was very effective in persuading people not to come out in the street.
Christopher Black, thank you very much for sharing your insights on this subject.
You're very welcome.
Christopher Black is an international criminal lawyer based in Toronto, a member of the Law Society of Upper Canada, and is known for a number of high-profile cases involving human rights and war crimes. And he writes for New Eastern Outlook and is published at Global Research. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. For a more in-depth look at the Syrian crisis, we're joined right now by Professor Tim Anderson. He's a senior lecturer in political economy at the University of Sydney in Sydney, Australia. He's written several articles on the Syrian crisis for Global Research and is soon to publish the forthcoming book, The Dirty War on Syria. So, Professor Anderson, thank you very much and welcome to the Global Research News Hour.
Thank you.
Okay, so I understand that you have been to Syria yourself, and I'm kind of curious to if maybe you could relay some of the impressions you got about Syrian society.
Sure. Yes, I went twice. I've been twice during the conflict with Australian delegations. The first one was we were hosted by the Higher Education Ministry because I was an academic and I was leading that delegation. The second one was through the Sports Institute, and some Australian boxers came over to do some exchange with Syrian sports people. So we were shown around the country a bit by the sports people there. It's a very big sports sector in Syria. In fact, one of the impressions, I mean, you have to learn a lot about a conflict by reading, of course, but then when you go to a country, you get impressions that either reinforce or change that a little bit or draw your attention to some things you hadn't paid attention to. And one thing that I noticed about Syria is that it's a very organized country with a very strong public sector. So there's pretty much free education, including university education, free health, and very large participatory sports programs. So when I mentioned we went in July this year with a group of boxers, you know, we were looking at sports facilities around the country with thousands of young people doing swimming lessons and all sorts of things. So there's a very strong, participatory sports ethos there. Also, we met delegations of disabled athletes who were going to the Special Olympics in the US and so on. So really, going to the universities, for example, I was really quite surprised because I'm at a university which has about 60,000 students, which is pretty big by our standards. Damascus University has over 200,000 students. Tishrin University on the coast has about 150,000 students. And the higher education minister 2 years ago told us that the government was very proud of the fact that they only charge $10 a year in fees, a nominal fee, in other words. So So a lot of young Syrian people are getting a very full education, and the other thing about that is that the culture is very strong on Arabic education. So you'd find that level of cultural development in the Arabic language is very, very powerful there. So that has an impact on a lot of things. It means that there's a general high level of education in the community. A lot of people are engaged with public institutions and so on. So that's quite different, really, to, I suppose, a liberal society where there's much more emphasis on individual commerce and so on. Of course, there's business and commerce in Syria too, but that was one of the impressions I got. There are others, but some of them were reinforcing the impressions were reinforcing what I'd read, and that is that Syria is famous for, not just in recent decades or since the recent independence and in the last century, but for centuries, indeed more than 1,000 years, of being a very pluralist sort of melting pot, basically. Partly because of where it is in the world, on the crossroads, but also because it's hosted so many minorities in the past. And the Druze people were said to have sought out Syria precisely because they wanted to live in a very pluralist, accepting sort of culture. And so you find with the Islam of Syria, there's something they call Shami Islam, which is about the Sham, which is Damascus area, which is, as you probably know, one of the most oldest continuously inhabited cities on earth, something like 10,000 years. Sham and Ham were meant to be the sons of Noah, created these towns in Hama and the Sham, which is now Damascus. So that pluralism, the recognition by Christians of Muslims and Muslims of Christians and so on, is something really part of the everyday life of Syria, and in particular Damascus. And if you look at the oldest mosque in Damascus, it has the minaret of Jesus the Christ, it has a Jewish Star of David, it has some of the remains of John the Baptist and Muslim leaders and so on. The Temple of Jupiter by the Romans is out the front. So it's in your face, and in stone in many respects, this pluralism that's so famous of the Syrians. And the Syrians really respond to that. They're very well aware of it. They're well educated, and they really enjoy that. It's part of their identity to be inclusive and pluralistic.
That portrayal that you've just expressed seems to come very much at odds with much of the what we've been seeing in mainstream media and coming out of the mouths of mainline politicians, and especially in the context of Bashar al-Assad, who is being portrayed as a very authoritarian and despotic leader. I was wondering if you could, distinct from other countries in the region as well.
Yeah, I mean, that line that you correctly sort of summed up is something quite recent. I mean, you wouldn't have read much about it before 2011. Probably they branded his father, Hafez, authoritarian after he crushed the Muslim Brotherhood rebellion in Hama back in 1982. But Bashar himself as a person, and I met him 2 years ago, is really not much different to what you would read about before 2011. A mild-mannered eye doctor who was conscripted into the position after his father died, basically. And he's not a brute at all in the manner of George Bush or Saddam Hussein, for example. He is a mild-mannered person. I've met him. And the thing that struck me most strongly about the things that were of concern to him when he met us, and he knew that we were friends, we were an Australian delegation against the war on Syria. The thing that struck me most was he said that he was very concerned about how they were going to deal with the children who were witnessing atrocities in the street. That is to say, I'm talking about Islamist atrocities where someone is murdered while other people chant God is great, Allahu Akbar, what sort of impact that was having on children was something that bothered him very deeply. We spoke about politics and a whole range of other things, the Geneva talks and so on, but that thing, thinking about the cultural impact on children of this ongoing conflict and the atrocities that they're seeing, not just atrocities, but atrocities with a justification, a pseudo-religious justification for those sorts of atrocities. So the idea of Syria as simply as an authoritarian state, and of course it has been authoritarian, and there are reasons for that. One was the Islamist the sectarian insurrections in the past, the war with Israel, the fact the country was surrounded by enemies effectively after the invasion of Iraq, and with Israel having been at war with Israel for so long.
Mm.
But socially, it has always been a very pluralist society, there's plenty of evidence of that. And if you look at most of the Western writings about that before 2011, a lot of them reflect that too. It's true that Washington's policy, at least since the 1970s, when the U.S. was kicked out of Iran and when I think President Jimmy Carter declared the Persian Gulf an area of vital U.S. interest and so on, they were talking about trying to depose Hafez al-Assad and what alternative they put up to him. But that's more or less the way an imperial culture thinks. That's the way U.S. culture thinks about lots of countries. Anyone who visited Syria in recent decades would tell you something very similar to what I said
In 2011, though, there was a political reform movement that was not necessarily an Islamic sectarian revolt. I mean, there was some, but I guess my understanding is that it somehow got overtaken by these sectarian elements.
That's right. There's a reform movement which goes back to the period when Bashar became president in the year 2000. And indeed, he was seen as a symbol of reform for many people and still is in Syria. In 2011, there were big political reform demonstrations and pro-government demonstrations in response. And one interesting way to look at the character of that or the composition of that is to go back a little bit further to 2005, when there was a statement called the Damascus Declaration, which was an opposition statement, critical of the government in a number of respects and spelling out a very broad agenda, because it was probably the most inclusive opposition statement of Syria in recent generations, basically. That group fell apart very quickly after that with their own contradictions. But what really happened in March 2011, and I've documented this fairly carefully in my book because it's part of the contemporary mythology of the Syrian conflict, was that there were political reform demonstrations, but under the cover of that, the Islamists started their insurrection. And it was planned, it was backed by the US, it was backed by the Saudis in particular, in the southern town of Dara. And really they drove the demonstrations off the streets. Demonstrators of political reform don't typically go out with machine guns and grenades and so on. And if you go back to the declaration in 2005, which did include all of the political factions, or most of the political factions at that time, the Kurds, the communists, the Islamists to a certain degree, even though the Muslim Brotherhood was banned, they were in there, the other nationalist and secular opposition parties and groups, they were very much against armed attacks on the state and attacks on the army, very much against it. The declaration, as critical as it was of the government, was completely against armed attack on the state and armed attacks on the government. They were also against foreign support of political opposition.
Mm.
So, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood was the first to fall out of that and the first to seek foreign support for an armed insurrection, which in Dara was almost a mirror image of what they did in Hama 29 years earlier. And I document the parallels there and the evidence for it. Yet the story that happened in the Western media, I call it the corporate media rather than the mainstream media because it's really run by big elite corporations, that story reinforced by groups like Human Rights Watch, which claim to this day, quite falsely, that the opposition didn't become seriously violent until September 2011. That's quite false. There's overwhelming evidence that the armed groups were carrying out an armed insurrection in the middle of March 2011, contrary to what the Western media still tends to say about what was going on there. And it was quite a distinct process, insurrection, to the political reform rallies. The political reform rallies were driven off the streets by that armed insurrection and the conflicts between the army and the armed groups. If you go back even to the United Nations monitoring body, which stopped taking body counts on deaths in Syria sometime in early 2012, that's to say about a year, a bit less than a year into the conflict, they found that there was about 5,000 killed in that first year, and a little bit over half of them were police and soldiers.
Mm.
Now, that's just been written out of the history of, and I mean, in my book, I detail the particular massacres of soldiers in particular places that evidence has come out now. You know, we've had 5 years looking at this. It's not, there are lots and lots of sources on the Syrian conflict. There, you know, there's a lot of video online and so on of funerals of people killed and so on. So there's no real shortage of information, but the mythology that the Western media has generally created in support of their governments is that these were peaceful protesters just being mown down. All of the deaths were caused by the army and the government, and that's quite false.
All those layers of propaganda are enabling this conflict, the demonization of Assad and the portrayal of this whole conflict is about a humanitarian intervention to save the struggling people of Syria. You mentioned Human Rights Watch, you know, this human rights body. You in your book, and I assume that your references are all primary sources and, all that available stuff, and yet a human rights organization is not relying on that. They're relying on something called the Syrian Observatory of Human Rights, which, as I understand it, is just one guy.
Yeah, well, I mean, the media has tremendous reliance on that one guy in England. Yeah, there are a couple of other organizations, similarly named organizations. They are the ones that are relied on by Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. Those groups, those US-based groups, the Amnesty US, USA, which has had the strongest voice on Syria, and Human Rights Watch, which is, you know, a US body created during the Cold War, basically monitoring the Soviet Union, more recently funded by George Soros to a tremendous degree. They use those Islamist-linked groups. That guy, Rami Abdulrahman in Coventry in England, is part of the Muslim Brotherhood. He flies the flag, you know, the three red-starred flag of the Free Syrian Army on his website. There's no secret about it. But it's true that the Western corporate media places an extraordinary reliance on really citing that source as facts. Rami will say 31 civilians, including 15 children, killed here, you know. How does he know that? He rings up some of his friends in Syria. Who are his friends in Syria? People who are directly fighting the government, you know, an overtly partisan source. And here's the, you know, without going into a particular example, here is the methodological error of the Western corporate media, not that they're going to listen to what I say about it, but they rely on an overtly partisan source to present their what they consider to be facts, basically. And then you might have paragraph 8 or 9, the regime denied this, something like that. But because Rami, the self-styled Syrian Observatory on Human Rights in England, says so many people killed, they were all civilians, they write it. By the way, this is a tactic that some anti-Syrian journals exposed back in 2011, 2012. There's a guy called Nir Rosen, who used to be a US journalist. I think he's an academic these days. He's written a fair bit on Syria. But back in early 2012, he was saying the game of the Islamist groups back then, and this is not ISIS because ISIS hadn't entered the Syrian scene until then, but Jabhat al-Nusra and the Free Syrian Army groups, which have always worked together, was that they would simply add up a whole lot of dead people and call them all civilians killed by the army. And it typically included, first of all, their own casualties. So that was a pattern started very early. The Melkite nun, Sister Agnes Mariam, was saying the same thing, that she was very hostile to the idea of numbers of people killed back in 2011 because the Free Syrian Army was recycling photos of dead bodies to create their new list of numbers, basically. So she was wanting to, and she began a project to try and identify the particular people, what families they came from, what their names were, instead of buying into this numbers game. Well, we've seen the same thing more recently with the barrel bomb campaign, which Human Rights Watch and its boss, Ken Roeth, have been at the lead of in 2014-2015, claiming that through this particular type of technology, which the technology is not so important, but they're just claiming that the Syrian army is indiscriminately bombing areas and killing civilians at some tremendous rate. And based on those claims, Amnesty International has picked it up and said collateral damage of 100 to 1, basically. But they're using the same Islamist sources. Now, when you look at the, and I go into this a little bit in the book, when you look at the areas that are said to be barrel bombed in the last few months, for example, this is a little bit prior to the Russian initiative in October, you find that they're all the holdout areas that have been held for 3 years by the opposition. In Douma, for example, in northeast Damascus, it's been a source of mortars coming into Damascus for the last at least 3 years. That area has been certainly been intensively bombed by the Syrian Air Force and artillery, but not flattened. It hasn't been carpet bombed in the way you say that the Fallujah was in Iraq back 10 years ago. Because up until about January this year, there were still evacuations going on of civilians from that area. In fact, the Western media showed very large scale evacuations, thousands of people from this outer northeast suburb of Damascus in Douma. Now, more recently, about 2 or 3 months ago, there were a lot of stories around the world of barrel bombing and supposedly all civilians. When you looked at the video of those bombings, there weren't people killed and injured in there. They were all fighting age males. There was one teenage boy, but no children, no women. Really, you know, every Syrian will tell you, everyone in Damascus will tell you, they actually want the government to go in much harder into Douma than they've gone in there. These people, by the way, which is a combination of two groups, Jabhat al-Nusra, the official al-Qaeda, and the Islamic Front or Islamic Army, they then put on the jackets of a group that was created in Wall Street called the White Helmets. Well, they've got little jackets and helmets sometimes too, to carry the wounded and dead people out and so on. They're the ones that are effectively reporting, claiming to be a civilian force. They are actually the armed groups themselves, and the civilians were the armed groups themselves in Douma, for example. Much the same applies to northeast Aleppo, the other area that's been held for a long period of time.
Mm. So, you have those different militant Islamist extremist groups. I'm kind of curious to know where the Kurds and Kurdistan fits into this picture, because they don't seem to be easy allies with the Syrian government, and they certainly aren't allies with these Islamic extremist groups either. Like, they're not, so you know, they just kind of an independent player, or how are they aligning with the conflict as it's playing out?
Yeah, good question. The Kurds are, of course, mainly in four countries, Iran, Iraq, the biggest group in Turkey, and in Syria. And, you know, historically, they had a very bad relationship with Saddam Hussein in Iraq, and they've still got a very bad relationship with the government in Turkey, of course, which has been bombing them quite recently, leading to some of those evacuations of refugees from those areas. Because, of course, a number of the Syrian Kurds had gone across to seek shelter in Turkey, but then they find them, the Kurdish militia being attacked by the Turkish government. In Syria and in Iran, I think it's fair to say historically they have had a better relationship with the governments there than they did in Iraq and Turkey. But still, there's a strong independent streak of Kurdish nationalism there. It's rather fragmented in the sense that Kurdish groups don't always agree amongst themselves. Most of them are Sunni Muslims, but you're quite right to say that the ISIS was attacking them. So this, by the way, gives you another signal of something that's going on in the conflict. This is not a conflict about Sunni Muslims against other religious groups. You know, the ISIS has killed more Sunni Muslims than anyone else in Iraq and and Syria, even though they demonize the Shia Muslims and other religions. So most of the Kurds are Sunni Muslims, and they have been fighting ISIS. And from the Syrian side of things, without trying to make it a little bit less complicated, the major militia, the YPG, has had a type of agreement with Bashar al-Assad in Damascus for a number of years now. But they've also got US help when they can get it. So the problem is that introduces a tension between the Turkish government, which is a strong ally of the US government, basically. There's a conflict also with Saudi Arabia there, because the Saudis, who almost overtly back ISIS, don't have the same approach to the Kurds as the Turks do. In Iraq, the US, again, I think it's fair to say, there's a lot of evidence on it, they have used the Kurds in the north of Iraq as a means of ensuring that Baghdad doesn't get too independent. This is one of the sources of conflict in recent years, that the Bush administration introduced a new type of policy in 2005, 2006 in Iraq, in occupied Iraq, worrying that the new government in Baghdad that they'd installed after getting rid of Saddam Hussein was going to get too close to Iran. That indeed happened. Iraq got close to Iran, is still very close to Iran. Now the Iraqi government in Baghdad doesn't trust the US military to go into the field with them against ISIS, because they believe they're supporting ISIS directly as well as indirectly. And on the other hand, they have used Iranian support to carry out those sorts of operations. So that was behind the US getting rid of al-Maliki in Iraq, claiming that he was a Shia sectarian. I think that was unfair and exaggerated. They were worried that al-Maliki was cooperating with Iran and Syria. More recently, Iraq has is beginning to engage with the Russians, and has the headquarters of the Russian intelligence operation against ISIS shared with Iran and Syria. So there's a counter movement going on there, which Iraq plays an important role in. But I've diverted a little bit about the Kurds. The US has used the Kurds to weaken Baghdad, to try and have a partner where they can basically control the region, because if Baghdad gets too much independence, that can be undermined by having regional ethnic or religious-based groups, and the Kurds are one of those. So that's why, I suppose, if you look at the character of the US so-called war on ISIS, you would see that there has been a genuine US engagement in, I would say it's like herding or cattle prodding ISIS away from the Kurdish areas. You remember when they attacked the Yazidi people, one of the Kurdish groups, and the US came in to herd them away there. But they've given them ISIS free rein to go into Syria. For example, when they took that ancient city of Palmyra, there was absolutely no US action against the big convoys of ISIS vehicles that went across and pushed out the Syrian army that were in Palmyra there. So, as I said, there's been this type of a relationship between the government of Bashar al-Assad and the YPG and the Syrian army. That means the Syrian army and the YPG in the north of Syria. But because there has been a US presence there and a US support for the Kurds have really have been a little bit more fluid and not entirely agreed amongst themselves about it.
So I understand from your upcoming book, you link and document all of the links between the U.S. Western powers and these ISIS and the other Islamic brigades. And I guess I just wanted to ask, you know, finally, when can we expect to see the book come out?
Well, I'm talking with Global Research at the moment about it. I think the latest is that they're looking at a possible serialization of the book, because production of the book traditionally takes many months, and I'm really trying to encourage them to do something a bit sooner. And it may be that a serialization will happen, so that three chapters will come out at a time in fairly short space. I hope that's what's going to happen, because I would like to see it out sooner rather than later.
Okay. Well, it sounds like a fascinating read, certainly based on the articles that you've written already, which have appeared on Global Research. Professor Anderson, Tim Anderson, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us on this subject.
Well, thank you for your time.
We've been speaking with Professor Tim Anderson. He is a senior lecturer in political economy at the University of Sydney in Australia. And his upcoming book is called The Dirty War on Syria. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.